Hello, everybody, and welcome to Weekly Manga Recap here on November the 18th, 2015. I'm Y-Rot, here alongside Rolo T. Chris, how are you doing?
I'm good, Nick. I'm about great. You know what? Let's bump that up to great. It was good before. I've upgraded. I'm great now.
You gotta look at your 10-point scoring system in terms of how you're feeling right now.
I had to gauge it. I have a spreadsheet I function off of. And yep. I had to do some calculations, had to see where I was at. I had to grade exactly the food I ate today. How did that raise my score? I stepped in dog turd. That lowers it. my mouth's no longer numb. From the dentist. Don't get weird thoughts, everybody. So that bumps it up a little bit. It was a lot of complicated systeming that went into it, but I realized I'm actually great.
I'm glad to hear that. I've had a good couple of days, too. Just a lot of good stuff's been happening. And it looks like that trend is going to continue because we have... with us, a special guest. It's Hope Chapman, a.k.a. Yezu Otaku. Hope, how have you been? It has been... I actually looked up this episode after you confirmed with us that you had to show up. It has been 4 years since you showed up on the podcast, almost to the day. When we talked about over on Host Co-op.
Yeah, I was remembering that. I was like, I swear I've been on WMR before, and it's like, what was it? It was like, oh, right, it was Host Club way back when. Yeah. But yeah, things have been good. Things have been really good, actually, recently. So, we're doing a lot of different projects for Anime News Network. I mostly do stuff for Anime News Network now. Getting ready to release first like big beta of the visual novel I've been working on. So, yeah, things are good.
What's the name of that again? I keep on forgetting. It's a weird title.
Yeah, it's a weird title. It's called...
Oh, you're going to insult her.
Weird does not mean bad.
It is a weird title. Like, straight up. It was like, I can't think of another title for this that doesn't just give stuff away or is even more awkward. So, the title is Lovely Little Thieves, and it's sort of a dating game. You enter a sort of stereotypical 80s haunted mansion... with five 80s horror characters, four guys and one girl. And they're all dating options, quote-unquote. You can fall in love with them, but they might also die horribly, so there's that, too.
It sounds a little bit inspired by Hatofu Girlfriend. A little bit.
By what?
I never remember. The pigeon one!
Hatofu Girlfriend? Not really.
As absurd, because you're... have people as opposed to...
Right, it's actually, the premise is a little more absurd, the story is actually fairly serious, I think the cast is introduced to stereotypes, and then very quickly it's like, oh, these are just sort of normal people, like the stoner isn't just a stoner stereotype, and like the rich bitch isn't just a rich bitch, but initially they sort of appear that way, but the story is not... really a parody or anything. Honestly, there's a lot of dating sim parodies now, how to full boyfriend style, like you can date a cake or whatever, or you can date a donut. There's stuff like that where it's like the entire thing is just a joke, and this is kind of played straight. This isn't really a joke. But it's meant to be kind of scary and fun. So yeah.
Now that actually, surprisingly enough, I think that has more to do with Ouran Host Club than the series that we're talking about today, I think, because that actually had, both of them had to do with dating, as opposed to this series and Ouran Host Club are comedies set in high school, and I think that's where the similarities end, basically.
Yeah, basically.
They both have human characters.
They're both manga.
They're both meant to take place in a general same kind of time frame, 21st century.
Although this one started in the 20th century, technically.
True.
Yeah.
So it's only
They're both two of my favorite anime comedies of all time. So there's that.
But very different types of comedy. This is
very different.
This is Great Teacher Onizuka, which is... I'm not going to start off by saying it's about a teacher named Onizuka. It's about a guy named Onizuka who starts off as this essentially complete loser, has very little prospects, very little motivation for what to do in life, and he kind of lucks into this date with this girl who's mad at her current boyfriend, and it looks like they're going to do the deed when suddenly said boyfriend shows up. It turns out he's her teacher, and she is so glad to see him, she immediately, not only immediately forgives him, but she, like, leaps out of the window and or into his arms. Mm-hmm. And not only is this guy, like, her teacher, but he's, like, this little, chubby, balding guy. And so Onizuka concludes immediately, oh, man, the way to get girls is to become a teacher. Because, you know, you can, students will really rely on you and form a great, deep connection to you. So he decides to become a teacher because of that.
Mm-hmm. To get chicks.
Which
seems like a bad idea.
Specifically, yeah. High school chicks.
Yeah, so it's all kinds of, oh, that's the worst idea you could have had.
Now, Onizuka is still, he's like 22 years old, so, I mean, if you say like, oh, what if he gets with Gareth, an 18-year-old, that's not as creepy as it could be. But then, of course, he does end up teaching high school seniors, so, again, creepiness comes up.
Right, well, the premise, it sounds like maybe a setup for a terrible ecchi show, where it's a bunch of girls flinging themselves at him, but that is not at all what happens to him in his quest for greatness.
I get the feeling that that's probably where the idea for the series came from, was what if we sort of play with the idea of, you know, high school harem comedy by having the teacher surrounded by the beautiful girls, but he actually wants to end up with all of them, as opposed to, oh, all these girls want me and stuff. But no matter what he tries to do, none of them actually want to get with him.
And right.
He just keeps embarrassing himself over and over again. Except he also embarrasses his students, too, quite a bit.
Right. I think another impetus for the series was probably the idea of he was a juvenile delinquent. Like, he's very much he's a social pariah as far as, like, respectable people in Japanese society. He's kind of at the bottom of the list. And so I think another large part of it was, like, what if this total social pariah gained some sort of, like, power over people and some kind of influence just by being himself? And so it's, like, he actually kind of becomes a teacher. Right. Like, for real, even though not conventionally, not like he's not like an amazing academic mind or an inspiration
or
anything. Yeah, he's an idiot, but he's very good at what he does, which is, weirdly enough, teaching these high school students, many of them like just sociopaths, to be decent people, which is interesting. Yeah. It's like, anyway.
It's as if, you know, someone said, what if the last person that you would ever expect or want to have a position of authority and respect got it?
Exactly, yeah.
And so Onizuka, he ends up landing an actual teaching job. Basically, he passed the test to become a teacher by attending the whole course that you have to get pass in order to be certified. He bonds with this one student that he is, you know, basically assistant teaching for. And by basically being this thick-headed and direct person, he fixes her family situation by destroying their home, basically.
He does. Well, it's they're having, like, a falling out. Her parents are having a falling out where they, like, go to bed in separate rooms, and her dad got a better job, so they're in a bigger apartment and everything, but they, like, yell at each other a lot. They, like, they're silent over dinner. They're both sort of cheating on each other or whatever, and then they, like, sleep in separate rooms, and so by the end of the story, Onizuka, this not the whole story, but just this first adventure in the manga, literally takes a sledgehammer to the house and just knocks down the wall so that they're forced to confront each other and have real conversations and things like
that. He breaks down the walls between them, but he's probably not aware of the metaphor that he just...
No, he's not, realized. Probably. But just property damage that he thought would solve the problem. I think he's not even... He's wearing, like, sweatpants, and that's kind of it. He walks in just, like, basically naked, sweatpants, with a giant sledgehammer. So they think he's like, some crazy person, some psycho, come in to, like, kidnap or torture them, and he just busts down large swaths of their ritzy apartment and leaves. You know.
I feel like making a professional wrestling reference right now, but then that would cut you out of the conversation. So.
Now, I'm sure we get the gist. It seems like something a professional.
Triple H was just trying to fix Randy Orton's house life, man. I mean, damn.
I was about to say, Nick, you're like, I don't want to do it as a guest in here. Might not understand wrestling, despite the fact, like, probably 80% of our audience is like, what are you?
Yeah, but they're not
about?
Actually here. I don't have to listen to them. I'm just kidding. I love all of you viewers. Oh God.
But you're referring to the fact that it's sort of like a subversion, a little bit of like a harem. It's also a subversion in the way it handles a teaching series, because we've read a lot of series where it's a interesting, eccentric character comes in to lead a classroom full of students. You think back to Assassination Classroom, Rookies. You know, we've seen this kind of dynamic before of a teacher who's going to take these group of characters, usually like considered the worst group of kids in the entire school, which is the same case here. It's what, class year two, class four, something like that. I can't remember the exact number, but they're supposed like the worst class that Onizuka gets. And the way he goes about kind of addressing their problems is extremely unconventional, in that many times it seems like he's doing horrible, horrible things, but there's generally a better purpose behind it. It's not
like he's... I got the feeling that sometimes he intended to help them, and sometimes he was just being his stupid self, and that worked.
Right. I think sometimes it's not necessarily that he doesn't have any aspirations of being like an inspirational teacher or whatever. It's sometimes he just sees a problem and he's had enough of it and he reacts in his own very specific, honest, like ridiculous way. The biggest example at the beginning of the show is that he's not going to be accepted. He's not going to be accepted as a teacher by the principal of the principal who's sort of a miserable guy. And isn't happy with himself, and he takes it out on other people that he perceives to be socially like.
Oh, he also takes it on people who destroy his car multiple times.
Well, yeah, but that was even before. That was way before Onizuka started destroying his car all the time.
Considering that he does just blatantly grope people on the train, yeah,
he's a bad guy. And so his name is Uchi Yamada, and he's sort of a miserable old fuck. Is the short version, but like he won't let Onizuka become a teacher, and he eventually gets overwritten on this. But he gets overwritten on this because he insults after rejecting his application. He insults Onizuka to his face and really gives him a takedown in front of everybody, like all the other teachers and a large swath of the students in the hallway. And unable to control his rage at this, Onizuka.
Well, first, like a bunch of punks basically come in and are gonna like start causing crap. So Ishiyamada's like, "Hey, Onizuka, you're a tough punk.
Yeah.
I'll actually employ you if you get rid of these trashy nothings." Yeah. And so Onizuka's like, "They're not trashy nothings." And then yeah, he gets behind Uchiyamada, grabs him by the waist, and German suplexes him.
Yeah, exactly. And then he thinks, okay, well, I'm definitely not going to get hired now. I burned that fucking bridge. And weirdly enough, that's the thing that ultimately gets him hired, because the superior, like the principal above that principal, like the actual head of the school, is a weird eccentric, and she thinks that this could bring good to the school. And it ultimately does, but yeah, like it's stuff that really should get him fired, and sort of just because it allows people to open up and talk to one another and, like, start being honest because he's being honest, ends up just progressing him further in life. So, you know.
And the rest of the series after that it's more episodic stuff than really a lot of ongoing plots. I mean, there's stuff like Uchiyamada really doesn't like Onizuka. That's just kind of an ongoing thing. There are always students who really don't seem to get along with Onizuka for one way or another. Some of them bear grudges longer than others, and some of them have better reasons than others.
Yeah.
But
some of them have very valid reasons for disliking him.
Oh, yeah. Stop hitting on my mom, for example.
Totally valid reason.
But the thing that is, not only does the class that Onizuka is saddled with, not only are they the worst students, they also have this reputation for driving all of their previous teachers absolutely insane. Like, one of them has joined a cult. One of them binge eats. Well, no, wait, those are the same one. Whatever. One of them joins a cult and binge eats. One of them has actually committed suicide, and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. And so that's basically why Onizuka is employed, is because, well, this guy's tough. I'm sure that his bizarre, tough-minded behavior will allow him to just survive this, and maybe he'll turn something stuff around.
Right.
And also, Onizuka is just kind of crazy enough to fit in among the madhouse as well. This guy has this really weird penchant for driving cars really fast because he has to get places.
Right. It's clear, like, the GTO thing, the great teacher Onizuka, is also a play on words for the car, the sports car GTO. You know, because that's kind of his thing, is, like, he's into motorcycles and cars. Well, I think his best friend is more into motorcycles. He's more into cars. And so he says, I'm going to be GTO, thinking, like, meaning he's going to be the flashiest, coolest model of teacher, is kind of the way he's thinking of it. which I don't know much about cars. GTO probably.
I don't know.
A really nice car. I don't know. But it's that's probably, I believe, like a really nice classic car. I don't know.
So do you... Crap. Never mind. I lost my train of thought. Okay. Let's start another one. Okay. So Onizuka's seems to just have this bizarre habit of just... Sometimes he just acts weird, and I kind of have, like, two theories about it. I think part of it is because he just wants the students to actually, like, pay attention to him. So he'll show up to class in all these weird outfits, like, just constantly. He shows up as, like, Devil Man at one point. One time he literally shows up with basically, like, an anatomical cutaway type of thing, like half his body is like muscle structure and stuff, and then it turns out he didn't actually buy a costume, he just like went into like the biology class, cut the dummy in half and hollowed it out and wore that.
Yeah.
Which, who the fuck thinks to do that?
Well, he loves weird costumes, so he's like, oh, this would be funny, and you know. My favorite is, I think there's a one of the many attempts by the students. You said there's no ongoing plot, and there isn't really. It's a series of adventures. But if there's an ongoing plot, it's that the students all hate him at the beginning. There's like 30 kids, and they're all kind of characterized. And then over time, by the end of the series, it dwindles down to like one kid hates him, and then you have like a big story arc to kind of finally win over that last one. But it's a progression of fewer and fewer kids hate him, and then over time more and more kids love him, and it's this real gentle progression. But up at the beginning, they're absolutely trying to get rid of him like they have every other teacher. And so they Photoshop, back when Photoshop was kind of new. And
yeah,
it was,
yeah.
And yeah, it's the 90s, so like Photoshop was a little bit more like you had to be skilled in order to do it, so fake pictures are more immediately convincing. But they Photoshop him into like this crazy sex pervert scenario where he's like, sitting like naked with his junk kind of being like
he's in this
tortured
whole S&M horse.
Yeah, it's pretty intense, and it congrats, they made a very very detailed like weird picture of like an S&M thing, and so they blow that up and they post it all over the school thinking it's gonna get him fired. And it does, like, there's a love interest who's another teacher. That's a nice thing, is the real love interest for Onizuka is obviously this other teacher who's his own age.
Right.
So, you know, that also kind of dissuades any of the creepiness. But, like, she sees it, and obviously now her opinion of him is ruined forever. So he decides the best way to fix this is to come to school dressed as an angel, like, literally in an angel costume with, like, foofy wings and a halo. And he just thinks that this is gonna solve the problem, and surely she'll see it all as a joke, and she'll, you know, and it's like, no.
He's like, do I look like the type of person who would enjoy that S&M dungeon? And she's like, no, but you look like the type of weirdo who would dress up like an angel, you freak.
Yeah, it's like, no, this is just as creepy, by the way. This just makes me think even more that you have a weird secret double life. You know, and, so the nerd character in the class is the one who makes the Photoshop, and he wins that guy over, and that solves that problem. And
well, he does it by, like, by saying, like, hey, so you can put any face on any body, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he wants to
So I got all these gravure models and these nudie pictures. Can you do that for me?
Mm-hmm. Right. So he's like, this guy is crazy, you know. This is not a role model. And yet they actually look up to him because he's very much honest. He's honest about himself, he's honest about his emotions, and he's honest about, like, they're obviously all headed down bad paths, and he talks with them about their family history and what's bugging them and what is bad in their life, and he gives his honest opinion on it, and just, you know, it's very different from what they've come to expect, which is adults talking down to them. He doesn't talk down to them.
Well, that's what kind of makes him a compelling teacher figure, is, as you said, he doesn't have a teaching degree. He's got no idea really on the educational aspects of this job. In fact, I struggle to think if there's any point he actually teaches them actual real education at any point. It feels like he just comes into class with wacky outfits a lot. But what
he basically is just reading from the book.
Yeah, but what
I'm reading it poorly, by the way.
But what he does have is he can relate to these kids. He's very empathetic with them because they're also, most of these kids are all kind of thought to be kind of junk or trash or failures in their own way or just bad kids. And he's the one who can kind of see through that and relate to them. He's like, he's able to make the connection with them and help them grow up as good human beings because of that. And, you know, that first example of just like, oh, he meets a guy who's using Photoshop to embarrass and humiliate them. Instead of teaching them, like, no, you know, the way to really kind of portray your outlet of your aggression is do it like this. He's like, oh, hey, I want to be a pervert too. Can you help me with my weird sexual fantasies and help me visualize them?
What do you mean
he
wants to be a pervert? He's already playing.
Yeah, he's like, already totally.
Can you help me out with this? Like, so that's his way of connecting
and then,
with them.
And then the guy like doesn't answer because he's so shocked and he's like, I can pay you.
So it's ultimately, I mean, the way I kind of look at the series is it's ultimately a comedy series that just has these dramatic ways of going about things. It usually ends on a, not a serious note, but there's usually a very silly way of solving the problem that ends with a genuine, heartfelt kind of moment between the characters. Because there's very few situations, I mean, there's a couple that he does solve in very dramatic ways. Like, there's quite a few times he actually stops people from committing suicide by leaping off the building with them and basically stopping that from happening. But then there's also times where he'll, there's some very odd times. I'll get into it more when we kind of go in further on the series. But he has some odd methods of solving problems towards the end. But ultimately, usually, even if there's a goofy way he addresses the problem, it almost always still ends with him having some kind of heart-to-heart, some kind of moment with one of his students that tries to help them forward. He puts one student in a beauty pageant. Like, that's just like it's a weird way he goes to try to solve her problem, but it was to kind of help her through her aggression and get her away from being bullied from these other girls and things like that.
I think that, I mean, there is something to be said for a teacher who can better relate to students. I had a teacher when I was in high school who had, like, been through the same program as the students that he was teaching, and he was, like, in his mid-20s by the time, like, all of us were, like, you know, 16 or 17 or whatever. And so because of that, you know, there were certain things that he understood that, like, you know, our 40s and 50s age teachers just could not. You know, technological things, like, he was into the same shows as us, and so on and so forth. And so because of that, he was a really popular teacher, and there were things that people were comfortable talking with him about that they weren't comfortable talking with the other teachers about. And so that is like a very realistic thing in Onizuka, is he is so similar to these kids, or can relate to their situation so much, because he was this dropout loser when he was their age. And so it makes that obvious when he, you know, suplexes Ushimata. He actually really does care about all of the lowlifes in society because he is one. Mm-hmm. And that gives him a different, you know, position than all the other teachers in the school. And that's why they grow to like him.
Right. And I think it's also notable to point out that the show, the manga as well, like, really points out the flip side of the coin to that, which is the idea, like, okay, well, being a respectable, good person in society won't really make you happy, like, necessarily. Like, it's okay to be a lowlife. Just, like, just be a good person, even if that doesn't mean you're a, like, an esteemed person by societal standards. Because, for instance, when the kid jumps off the roof, he's trying to kill himself, and Onizuka leaps to his rescue, like, literally jumping off the roof with him to try and break his fall, they fall onto the vice principal's Cresta, which, once again, a car, and it's like a nice, fancy luxury car, and that Cresta is a big, big point of contention for the vice principal, because he keeps breaking it, and he keeps rebuying it, and it's like he pours so much of his own self-worth into that car. His wife hates him, his daughter hates him, even the dog in his house won't give him the time of day. Because he's just kind of a shitty person. And he's like, but I did everything right. I went to school, I graduated, like, top of my class, I work hard, I'm a good working, like, husband and salary man. Why won't my family love me? Well, my family will love me if I buy this car. And it's all this stuff that's just tied into, like, sort of a conventional, this must be a successful person thing. But he's miserable. Like, Onizuka is a much happier person than Uchimata. Uchimata is just unhappy at all times. And it's not trying to be mean to him. It's just saying, like, look, these kids, they could have come up through, like, totally normal backgrounds and, like, had a successful school life or whatever, but they still wouldn't be happy because they could just end up like this guy. Like, the important thing is to, you know, be true to yourself and be honest with one another and to be a good person in your own way, even if you're a delinquent or whatever, you have issues or your parents have issues, that kind of thing. But yeah, like, so it's thoughtful in a way, but it's also funny because we get to see the only, like, the symbol of his masculinity just crushed over and over and over because they find new ways to keep destroying that car over and over as the series goes on.
It's a little bit things like... to that. First and foremost, I've never considered a Toyota Cresta a cool... Mm-hmm. I've never considered a Toyota car to be, like, a luxury high-class item. So every time he brings it, like, my Toyota Cresta! I'm like, that sounds ridiculous.
It's a big deal for him, I guess. I don't know enough
maybe
about cars.
That,
just
maybe me. That time in Japan.
Possibly, yeah. But
also, I did not know what a Cresta was before reading this series. I was like, what the fuck's a Cresta? Oh, the car, okay.
But I feel I'm too empathetic because I realize that he is a bad person. Like, he does a lot of awful things to almost everyone. But I just kept feeling bad for him when his car keeps getting destroyed. I'm like, oh, that costs so much.
It's so much money.
That's and so, you know, he's got to work becomes, so hard for that.
He becomes softer over time. I think, unlike everybody else who kind of goes from bad to good in some way, Uchiyamada is always a little miserable, but he does become a much better person over time, and he does soften. It just... not as immediately as everybody else, because they kind of need him to keep being awful for comedy purposes, but... like, you know, nobody's immune to Onizuka's influence. Like, he does chill.
And he has to be the driving force behind a lot of the attempts to get rid of Onizuka as well.
I have to say, I did feel sorry a bit for Ichimata sometimes. Like, for example, it was just like, wow, Onizuka's stressing him out so much that he's, like, killing himself. He's pissing blood, he's got gallstones and all that stuff, because he's so stressed out over Onizuka. Which, when you think about it, Onizuka is doing all sorts of terrible stuff, you know, driving really dangerously, taking students on rides to get them away from the police because he had them bungee jump off a bridge and stuff. He's doing all this awful stuff. But then there's that bit where, you know, it focuses on Uchiyamada and what his life is like. It's like, ah, oh, I'm gonna grip this girl's breast. It's like, oh right, he's an awful person.
Right. He's a weird pervert because he's so unfulfilled at home and stuff. But yeah,
it's a little bit like Frank Grimes if it wasn't played for dark comedy all the time. Mm-hmm. There's an actual point behind it.
Yeah, and you mentioned the bungee jumping off the bridge and stuff like that. Like, that's the thing that I like a lot about the series, is because its style of humor is just so unrestrained. It's like, normal, like, with the inspirational teacher stuff, even if it's a little bit subversive, you don't expect this level of hideous slapstick comedy. But, like, the stuff that happens to Onizuka, he gets bit on the dick by a snake, I think, maybe 3 times? He gets... like, a literal snake just clamps onto his junk at various points. I think, and his hands get super glued into bowling balls at one point. Just bad things happen to him, and
it's a weird series.
Yeah, it's weird.
It's full of all these... I don't know about the English... I'm sure, especially the English adaptation of the anime must not have as many cultural references... but, like, that bowling ball thing is basically just so you can get called Doraemon a whole lot, because his hands...
Well, they call him Doraemon, yeah.
And then he just, like, eventually the time comes because he's like, oh, my hands are stuck in bowling balls. Also, I'm not your teacher. I'm Doraemon, remember? Dur-dur-dur. Because they're getting bullied by these students from a different school. And then the time finally comes where he's like, actually, I'm not Doraemon. And then he breaks open the bowling balls by just smashing him on the ledge. And he's like, I'm Kenshiro! And he kills them, basically.
Yeah.
It's a weird fucking series, and it really seems to operate on the logic a lot of times, because there are serious moments, and there are dramatic moments of, oh, you know, here's this meaningful thing that happens, but basically, it is full-on a cartoon, and everything that happens tends to operate on the logic of, what would be funniest in this situation? Well, I guess he'll just, you know, drive across the bridge, you know, in a bus at 100 miles an hour, just because it'll be funny. Or, I guess he'll be late, and I guess he'll, you know, have the greatest misunderstanding possible again, so that people think he's a huge pervert, which he is, but not in the way that they think he is, and so on, and so on, and so on.
Well, I love the, after he saves the guy from committing suicide jumping off the roof, he Well, he lands on the car, and it seems like everything is fine. He's like, oh, what a cartoony, like, hey, they're both alive or whatever. And he comes to school the next day, and his arm is red and four times the size it should be. So it's obviously broken. And he's like, man, I must have been pumping iron. Like, I must have really gained a lot of muscle. And they're like, oh, my God, your arm is broken. Go to the hospital. And it's such a gross, like, sight gag. Because it's just giant,
and then it heals like, in like 2 days. It heals in like 2 days too, because Onizuka is inhuman, basically.
Yeah, it heals pretty quick because he's just, I guess, tough. Something, you know, because they need him to be in good health for the next story or whatever.
People have observed that Onizuka is just like unnaturally lucky, but I think it literally just is like what would be funniest in this situation, like. What, you know, he needs to solve a money situation. What would be the funniest way he could possibly solve it? If you just randomly won the lottery and then blew it and then had to win it again or something like that.
Yeah. He, another one of my favorite gags is, you mentioned that he keeps hitting on somebody's mom. Mariah is the biggest, like, bully, but a baby. He's sort of a short little dude. He's sort of a short little dude with like a crew cut, and it's dyed blonde, bleached, and he's like, take me seriously, but he's obviously sort of a mama's boy, and he's got like a lot of issues. He has a single mother, and she's like always seeing new guys and stuff like that, and it bugs him, like it threatens his fragile masculinity. And so when Onizuka starts taking an interest in his mother, it just fills him with such rage that they're at a pachinko parlor or something, and there's like a statue of a sumo wrestler. And he handcuffs Onizuka to the sumo wrestler so that he can't go on a date with his mother. And lo and behold, Onizuka shows up to the date holding in his arms this giant sumo wrestler statue, which is like the size of him.
He's
like a
ripped life-size. It out of the mechanism.
He ripped it out of the ground, and he is still handcuffed to it. And he's like, I'm going to make it, you know. And it's like, Jesus. And yeah, somebody points out in the chat that his mother had him at the age of 14 or something like that. So it's... He's got issues. And, you know, once again, like, they become friends pretty early. He's won over to Onizuka's side and stops bullying him when they start treating each other like equals. And he's like, well, no, let me talk. But he becomes therapist to his own students, basically, unintentionally. So they work through his issues with his mother and, you know, then they're buddies. But prior to that, you know, he kind of tries to kill him a couple times, glues his hands into bowling balls, handcuffs to a sumo statue.
Tries to trip him so that his face falls into scissors.
Yeah, seriously. Tries to
get him to swallow a cockroach so it will lay eggs in his stomach.
That is, I was thinking on how funny this series is, and I was like, there's a couple moments, because it's a very vulgar series. If you haven't grasped that yet, for those listening,
it's gross.
It's very vulgar. A lot of sexual humor, a lot of graphic humor. When Nick mentions that the vice principal is peeing blood at one point, it's not just something mentioned offhand. You see it a couple times.
You see when he's getting better and he's in the bathroom and he thinks that everything's okay because he's like escaped from being caught as a pervert on the train, and then he realizes that he thinks that Onizuka might have seen him, and he's also left his bag in the train, and Onizuka shows up in the bathroom and like gives him his bag back, and you see his pee turn to blood.
Yeah. But the things that are funny, there are really, like, very humorous points, and that, the cockroach is one for me, because it's, like, it's very something, like, out of The Simpsons in my mind, where they're like, oh, we'll put the cockroach in this food and make him eat it, and he's like, oh, you guys made me food? That's super awesome. All of you guys should have one. He just throws some on their plate, too, and the guy who put it in there, like, holds up his food, and he sees, like, the legs coming out of his food, he's like, oh, I got the cockroach. And then, like, by circumstance, like, he just gets bumped into the food. Like, Onizuka's like, hey, I'm awesome! And he knocks his head and just downs it in one bite.
Gross.
So, yeah, not only were these kids, like, willing to drive their previous teachers to death, they're willing to actually, like, commit murder.
Clearly, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, they become more desperate over time when the initial tactics don't work, you know, and it's like... It's like, guys, this is going to make you accomplice to murder. I know the first 12 things that were milder that you did didn't work.
We're minors. We'll get out.
I have to assume that police don't exist in this universe. Because no, there's
But as long as Onizuka gets back to school and calls base, he's fine, basically.
It really feels like there's times of, like, there should be police involved in this. I'm shocked police weren't involved in this.
Maybe the chancellor woman just, like, has mafia connections or some shit.
This is somewhat of a tough series because there are points to it where I legitimately just enjoy it. I think it can be very funny at times, and I like the different approach of him being this kind of a guy who feels like he's on the same level as his students, and he's not going to talk down to them, and he can very see the world from their point of view and tries to help them through it. But there are some points where his actions in trying to solve a problem are really questionable. There's an early one where the first kid he meets is basically assaulted again by a bunch of girls who essentially just sexually abuse him.
Oh, God. I'm so loudy with this one.
It's really like a very horrible situation that happens for this boy. So, and ultimately it has a good conclusion because Onizuka basically has her, like, whole, you know, like, that sort of thing where you record the villain and then play it out to the people, that sort of thing. Like, he recorded the girl talk about how no one's ever going to get her on this because her mom's the head of the student council and things like, or the parent-teacher council or anything like that. But his first way of solving this problem is to sneak in with the girls while they're all doing karaoke and then tie them up and sexually, like, take pictures of their butts so that the boy will have something against them.
And isn't he, like, spanking them while this is going on, too?
Maybe.
That's a different girl. He spanks another girl.
That's another one I wanted to touch on.
there's a couple. I think what makes the series work for me is that the show doesn't condone, it doesn't go, yes, this is the right thing to do. It's just the thing that ultimately works in the end because he's speaking the kids' language back to them. It's not necessarily like, this is the right tactic to take. It's just, this is what eventually led to the right solution. Because it's not actually his revenge. His revenge is a mistake, and he does actually almost get fired for it. But yeah, the idea is that these three girls are bullies. They find this guy, they push him down, they take off all his clothes, and they take pictures of his ass and his dick and stuff like that, and write things like, I'm a loser on it, in permanent marker. And, so he finds them, and yeah, what he does specifically, they're in karaoke, he ties their hands up so that they're, like, you know, hanging from the ceiling, and they can't escape, and then he writes in permanent marker on their underwear, I'm sorry, you know, I apologize, or whatever, and then allows the boy to take pictures of underwear. So it's not exactly the same thing, but it would be sexual harassment. It's not that it's a good thing to do because it most certainly isn't. It's just, okay, it makes sense that this is how Onizuka's brain works because he's an asshole, but it's not like that this is the best thing to do. It's just that what it leads to. So they take the pictures, and then they leave the pictures with them. He doesn't take the pictures with him. He leaves them behind and says, like, you can do with these whatever you want, but now you know what it feels like to have that space invaded or whatever, and to have I'm sorry written on your underwear. And so the girls take the pictures and do exactly what, of course, they're going to do, which is try to get him fired with them, saying, look what he did to us, like, this guy's a crazy pervert. And he does almost get fired, and the only thing that saves him is, again, the confession that she says, I can do whatever I want because my mother's the head of the PTA or whatever. And she still wants to get Onizuka fired, but when they have a private talk between her and her mother and they realize all the home issues that they have that have caused this giant rift between them, she takes back the charges. And it's not about Onizuka or what he did, because what he did was wrong. It was just about reforging this connection with her daughter. So it was, you know, he doesn't do the right thing. He just does the thing that ultimately gets people to address the real issue, if that makes sense.
Because, and again, so, he's unnaturally lucky because
he's lucky, and they need to keep the show going, etc. But, like, there's lots of things he does that are very much the wrong thing. And the biggest example of that is the most important student character that gets introduced halfway through the series is a transfer student named, I forgot her name. Urumi Kanzaki is the, the character, and she is the one character where his shtick doesn't work immediately. Like, there's plenty of people he hasn't won over yet, but straight up, the stuff that he does doesn't even have a remote effect on her, and she is going to absolutely destroy him, and she kind of almost succeeds. She has like over 200 IQ, and she's like got heterochromatic eyes, and she's kind of like scary.
She's my original character, do not steal.
She looks a little bit, like, more special than the rest of the students, and so she is going to absolutely destroy him, and she succeeds by playing to his, oh, I'm just a sad little girl and I need help. And he tries to help her in his normal way by playing therapist, by being like, oh, well, here's your problem. And it's all just lies. It's all just lies to guilt him into, she makes him think that he almost killed her. And then this forces him to capitulate to her and basically become her manservant. And so he does whatever she wants. And he becomes her genie, and she's like, genie, I need this, genie, I need that. And he just shows up and, like, does whatever she wants. And so he's lost. He's completely lost to her, and it goes on for a couple chapters like this, and it's like, oh, shit. Like, this is somebody he can't beat, and she's gonna absolutely get him fired. And so the way that resolves, my mind's a little fuzzy on that, so maybe one of you can explain it, but...
Is this the same... I might be mixing the people up. She's the one who also has the Taekwondo... train. I might be mixing this up with someone who's more towards the end.
I think
the one who starts beating up male students. Or is this? I might be mixing her up with somebody else.
I think that's somebody else. This is the blonde with the two color eyes and like is a super genius.
It's hard to tell with the two colored eyes in the black and white series at times.
That's very true. They just mention
it. He like kidnaps her with his biker gang. So
he does kidnap her with her.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah.
Again, what the fuck is wrong with you, Onizuka?
Well, the thing is that most of these situations that we've brought up as, like, his, like, what are you doing moments, they're all treated as comedic moments in the series. It's never like, this is him, like, this is legitimately how I'm going to solve this. It's not like he, like, tied the girls up in the karaoke room and was like, solved your problem there, young man.
Right. It's not like the series goes, oh, yes, this is, he has done a good thing, our Onizuka, yeah.
What a wise teacher he is. It's almost always treated as a joke, and then the real solution comes out of that.
Exactly. It's like the dumb thing. It's like he's making the sacrifice of the dumb, terrible decision in order for the real solution to come out, and the real solution comes out through the person being pushed into such a ridiculous corner that they just are emotionally honest with themselves and one another, and that's it. So he didn't necessarily have to do that, but it got the result in the end that, you know, he wanted, even though that probably wasn't his original intention, because he's not that smart. He's too dumb for that.
He can't be a wise strategist. He can't come up with proper schemes, so he just has to have luck. So.
Mm-hmm. And so I think this, I was trying to remember, the biker gang thing reminded me. I think ultimately he decides that... he's gonna end that basically because his world is sort of falling apart because of his mistake and being too nice and being taken advantage of by this super genius girl. He kidnaps her and just says, okay, I'm gonna drive off a bridge. We're gonna commit suicide together. Let's go. You know, vroom vroom. And I think that's what does it. I think it's like the.
Well, because she's. Well, it was because, you know, she had tricked him into thinking that. She had died, when in fact she claims that she doesn't actually fear death.
Yeah, she says she doesn't fear death or anything like that, and he's like, well, okay.
If you don't fear death, then I guess you're not going to care. Like, yeah.
She's a nihilist. She's like, the world is empty and pointless, and there's nothing to live for, and I'm just going to destroy you and everybody else. So he tests that, basically, and that gets her to finally, like, open up eventually. Because obviously, when they fly off the bridge, they don't die. Like it was a sort of a ploy, but you know.
No, because Onizuka was in a car, which means that of course he's going to be fine.
Right. So yeah.
That is actually one of the things that he does. That it's weird that like that's one of the craziest things that he does, and actually it's like actually no, that makes sense. I actually see where you were coming from with that one.
Well, he had to kind of outwit her. He had to outwit her a little bit because her entire thing was using her intelligence against him. So in order to get any kind of a leg up on her at all, he had to do something that she wasn't expecting.
Right.
You know?
Honestly, I think that my favorite was one of the earlier ones with Tomoko, where he enters her into the beauty contest because... And basically, she's essentially this the dumb blonde in the series. She's very pretty and, you know, busty and so on and so forth, but she's just manipulated by all of her supposed friends, and then they kick her out of their group because she fucked up one of their plans to get rid of Onizuka. And she's this innocent girl, and she's very naive and kind of stupid and slow, But Onizuka is like, no, no, you are not, like, worthless, basically. He just kind of knows that because, you know, he was seen that way. And to prove this, he enters her into this beauty contest, and when it comes time for, like, the acting portion of it, he plays on the fact that she likes to play with toys, basically like a little kid, to get her to act out this very amazingly over-the-top, super-dramatic scene with these action figures, where there's, like, this broken home life between a single mother and her kid, and she's, like, just coming up with everything on the fly, and she thinks that, and so she makes it seem like the mother's gonna die because the kid accidentally stabbed her, but no, it's okay, because her late husband left her a watch so that it would save her from death and also save his son from committing the act of murder. This amazingly dramatic thing that makes the entire audience cheer as, like, this is so stupid but so amazing at the same time.
Yeah, they changed that in the anime, actually. They changed Yeah, they did, because I think they thought maybe it was a little too weird that it didn't really fit in. It didn't fit in with the gravier thing that she was trying to do with the I want to become a model kind of thing, which she's eventually working toward. Like, it's a beauty pageant, but it's obviously the end goal is for her to become sort of a model or something. And so she enters into the beauty pageant, and she does fine with all the basic stuff where she just has to walk around and look pretty, and then it comes to the talent part, and she's like, I'm not good at anything, and he's like, no, you are, and so she's supposed to act out a scene, just like the sort of a J-drama type scene, right. And she's supposed to, and she can't really do it because she's like, I'm not an actress, I don't understand how to do this, and so he gives her a prop, it's like a phone. And it is connected to the girl, one of the girls, her former friends that was bullying her, and allows her to say that the script is kind of conveniently could also be a conversation with this girl that she's fallen out with. And so what it is what in the anime is actually her having a conversation on the phone with the friend that's estranged. And so she just kind of says what she really means, and it's a really convincing acting performance because she's not acting, and the crowd cheers and everything like that. So I think they shifted the babyishness of it to something that made a little bit more sense, while still retaining her character. Like, she's still the same person; she's still quote unquote the dumb blonde character who, you know, people underestimate and treat poorly or whatever. But she gets. You know, she gets what she wants in the end, which is, you know, she kind of gets a successful career and everything. Like, when she leaves high school, she'll be a model for a while and stuff.
Right.
So.
And also tying it into the conflict with her friends, I guess, makes more sense than just, oh, well, they played with toys earlier, so she's going to play with toys on stage.
Yeah, they change it. Well, I think that friend they give her, that friend, that's Miyabi, and she's the meanest of the characters. Like, just, she's the last one in the anime for Onizuka to win over, and I think that they wanted to build her up as much as possible because they knew that's where the show was gonna end. And so, Miyabi's winning over with Onizuka, like, finally stopping bullying him and also not becoming a shithead anymore is the big climactic end point of the anime. I think the manga goes on for longer, so. Yeah.
Okay.
I just want to note that there's a point in the series I really like. There's a lot of small stories that are very good. There's one very short one, I think it's only like three or so chapters long, that I really, really enjoyed, though. And it plays into the fact that this series, while being very cartoonish, while being very silly, does hit on some more mature themes and issues in it. And my favorite story is one that actually barely involves Onizuka at all. It actually deals more with his the other teacher at the school, whose name I'm forgetting, the love interest character, I forget her name.
Fuyutsuki?
Fuyutsuki, that's it. She is in her class. She's, from what you understand, she's an actual, like, teacher. Like, she actually probably has some academic degree or something.
Well,
she
actually wanted to be a teacher.
Yeah.
At the start. Like, Onizuka, basically, that experience when he's becoming a teacher makes him want to do the job well. And he kind of actually really quickly gives up on the whole, I want to fuck my students thing, which...
Yeah, very
thank
quickly.
God!
That's like...
he falls for this other teacher. Like, that's his love interest, is Fuyutsuki. And she's just, like, a very nice... She's just a very nice, like, sincere, woman who just wants to be a good teacher. She's very simple.
And she's a very good character, too. She's
good, yeah.
She has very endearing moments. There's a lot of times where people are trying to convince her that Onizuka is a bad person, and some piece of circumstantial evidence comes up to make it look like he is, but she'll say something like, I'll wait to see if that's the kind of character he really is. You know, like, basically playing the right faith with him. And she has this very small story arc where it shows her class, because you don't often get to see it, and you see that all the boys in her class love her, because they're going to try to hit on her, they're going to try and make remarks at her, and all this stuff. But you see that the real antagonism towards her in her class comes from all the girls who are now very angry and jealous about her doing it, and that's where she starts getting, like, threats put against her, and she doesn't really know how to deal with it. It starts, like, coming in that she has to almost consider if she'll stay at this job anymore, and Onizuka has this moment with her where he basically just takes her out into, like, a pond, and kind of just has, like, a real heart-to-heart with her, and kind of... It's not even, like, a heart-to-heart, it's just, like, a calm moment where they're both able to kind of relax, and she kind of reevaluates what herself is going... what she's going to be as a teacher, and she, you know, comes back at it. But it was just very interesting to see them take that kind of angle in that situation, how it would be presented, and have an arc that just focused on her, and her development, and her becoming a better teacher from this, and how she's going to relate to her students as well. Like, I liked seeing this cast beyond just Onizuka connect with each student, start to continue and grow. Even the vice principal has an arc where you see him start to kind of turn around, and he recognizes that his teaching style has fallen to the wayside. He's going to improve it. He's still kind of always a little bit of a shithead, but even he starts to kind of change a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I forgot exactly what it was, but he undergoes like a weird Onizuka adventure of his own, complete with weird costume. He ends up in a gorilla costume for some fucking reason, and
Of course,
he does. Yeah.
I mean, there's a point where Onizuka is in an elephant costume wearing his wiener. So
that's pretty fantastic. I think that was what's funny is like some of them obviously like are tied into the story, and like his costume choice is tied into whatever's happening, and some of them are just like clearly the author had a costume idea but he didn't know where to fit it in, so it's just like a scene will be introduced and he's wearing it and we don't know why. And that was one of, I think it was like there was a the board was visiting, like the vice principal is taking the board around the school and showing off the different classrooms, and he walks in and Onizuka has an elephant head like around his waist with big elephant ears off the side, and the trunk squirts water and he like blasts water out the door right when they come in. And he's like,
"Oh,
sorry."
Is this symbolic? What does this mean?
Giant,
I don't get it.
Penis, you know, so it's like, gee, thanks.
You gotta give Onizuka credit for some of the costumes he comes up with, because some are incredibly ornate, and the fact that he actually manages to get, you know, a giant elephant's trunk thing that actually squirts water and stuff.
It's elaborate.
How does this guy not have, like, a costuming job, seriously?
Well, my
cosplayers would come to him all the time.
Well, where does he put them? Because the thing we've neglected to mention he lives in the school.
He lives on the roof in a shack.
He lives in the tiny little accessible by stairway room that you see on a lot of Japanese school roofs. Like, that's where he lives, and he bathes in the sink and stuff like that. Like, he's, you know, so where does he put all these costumes? You know, he lives in a closet. What the, you know?
I mean, we saw where he got that anatomical W one, at least.
That's true.
He just cut it in half and stole it.
Abuse of school property.
Maybe like there's like a zoology teacher who's missing the head of their elephant model.
Yeah, basically, he hollowed it out and like fabricated a water spout.
This is going on my dick. I mean, yeah. Alright. Well, I guess if we want to get into, like, final thoughts on this, because we've been going for a little while. Yeah. I do admit that I think that, because we've read a fair number of series, I think, that are from around this time period that essentially deal with the character who is a bizarre pervert, and the world that they occupy is full of assholes and weirdos. This is probably the best of those that we've read, because we've read stuff like Pretty Face and Zippy Ziggy and so on and so forth that either did not go to, you know, the lengths that GTO does, or they would not really make their protagonist very likable. And that is a key difference, is that Onizuka, despite being this weirdo who really treats his students the way that they probably shouldn't, despite the fact that they are all little assholes, he's not the best kind of role model, but he does at least care. You kind of see that, and he's likable enough that you're willing to follow along with him. And also, it can be a very funny series. That said, I actually had a really hard time reading through this because it was just so weird and at times so mean-spirited that it was kind of tiring for me to read it. And there were a few times where I was like, I don't really find this particularly funny. It's just, it's a little too mean and too bleak. And then, of course, it got into more goofy stuff, and so it got better. But,
right.
So I don't know. I don't know if this is something that you're going to, like, want to marathon the way that Chris and I did in order to prepare for this. If you, like, you know, I don't know, read the occasional volume, or if you read a more condensed version, like the anime, or... Did I say read the anime?
Yeah, well, you could do that. You could just read the subtitles and block off the rest of the screen.
If you watch the anime or something along those lines, maybe it will make more sense to you. But I do have to say, it's like it can be good, but you should probably like check out the first volume or check out the first episode or whatever. Make your judgment based on that because you're going to encounter a lot of the same type of humor and stuff throughout the rest of the series.
I personally didn't find this story to be mean spirited. It is crude. I guess crude would be the word I would use. I didn't find it mean-spirited because it's so sympathetic to everybody, even the most terrible students, like, you find out have reasons for being the way that they are, and you feel bad for them. Like, even Miyabi's the last one to go. She's the meanest, she's the queen bee bully girl, and she, you know, by the end, like, even her, they finally characterize her in a sympathetic way. And Uchi Yamada, who's a terrible person, like, you know, everybody, unless they are really a disposable villain who's in a couple chapters and that's it, like, they all have hidden depths. It's just that they're all mean to each other because that's what drives the comedy, but they're all good people or capable of becoming good people. It's just that the actual comedy is rough and crude and nasty and, you know, and I like that about it. But yeah, if you're not into, like, really... really bizarrely gross sometimes humor, then maybe not. But I think ultimately, at the very end of the show, I don't know exactly where the manga finishes, and I know that there's spinoffs and stuff that continue it, but the end of the show, to me, was kind of put a nice end cap on everything that it was trying to do, which is that Miyabi, the worst girl, is won over by... She does something that is... basically, she gets into a liaison with, I believe, a family friend who's a teacher at another school or something like that, and she, it's for specific reasons that she's kind of seducing him. I don't remember what the exact reasons are, it's been a while since I've seen it, but it gets her in huge trouble, and the way that Onizuka solves this is it drives her back to her really kind of shitty, abusive parents. And the way he solves this is by he goes as far as he can possibly go, which is to literally hold her hostage, I believe. Or he gets blamed for the attempted murder of the guy that she injured in this seduction attempt, and then he like holds her hostage, and he officially breaks the law to such an insane extent that it can't really be excused, and that's enough to win her over and kind of end up saving her life and turning her around. The downside to this and what kind of ends the show is that he has to flee the country. So he's done being a teacher at that school. Like, so he's finally gone. He flees the country and he ends up teaching in America, and that's kind of how the series ends. But,
it sort of ends on a bleaker note in the manga because it basically after chapters and chapters and chapters of lucking out, like, he gets some sort of, like, weird illness, like I forget what exactly it is, but
basically
it's like
a brain but like, yeah, basically if he takes one more shot to the head, he'll die.
He can't take any more bumps, he's gonna retire from wrestling basically. So yeah, it's just like, well, that's why he can't do anything, is because he's done too much dangerous shit and it finally caught up to him.
Right, yeah, it's a little bit dark, but like I appreciated that it's like he really goes as far as he can possibly go. And they even play it up for comedy because it's like he has this meaningful moment with Miyabi and then right after that he's like fleeing the cops. And it's funny because it's like, you know, it's like this big action scene and he's like, oh God, what have I done? You know, but all's well that ends well, and his students are still able to contact him overseas. But it's like, I just like that because it takes the comedy to the furthest extent that it possibly can, but it's also very heartwarming and meaningful and, you know, mushy while still being, you know, ridiculously cartoony. So, Yeah, I it's one of my personal favorites. It is dated. It's like there's a lot of it, the crassness and the inappropriateness of that that hasn't aged well necessarily, and the episodic nature might not be to all tastes, although I do think it has a continuous arc. It's not purely episodic. But yeah, it's I like it a lot. It was, I think I like the character of Onizuka a lot. I just think he's really likable and funny, and even though he's a terrible person, kind of. But everybody is. Like, the show is kind of like, hey, everybody's terrible, but we're all really good deep down, too, if we can just get rid of the shitty parts, the pretense and stuff like that, and just be ourselves. So, yeah, it's nice. It's an oldie but a goodie, I think.
I think it's ultimately a comedy series, so a big portion of whether or not you can enjoy it is the subjective taste of, do you enjoy the kind of humor that the series is? So, as you said, it's a crude series, a lot of vulgar humor, a lot of sexual humor. If that doesn't bother or anything like that, I think there is a lot of merit to this series. I think it can be very funny at times. It does have very good, you know, heartwarming moments. I think it has a good message to it, and it's different, but I enjoyed that aspect of it, too. You know, it's not just this class full of people who are, you know, the odd ones out in today's society. It's the teacher himself as well, who's probably even more of an oddball than his students at most at certain points. I enjoy it for that. Reading the manga, though, it's a 22-volume series. And like any long-running comedy series, it drags at a certain point. I think it picks up about halfway through the series and it starts to get a little bit more enjoyable, but there's a point at the start of it where it is kind of a slog to get through because it just takes so long. And I think they condense a lot of those chapters into one episode of the manga, or into the anime. So I think if this series sounds intriguing to you, but you don't necessarily want to deal with that kind of length, I would recommend watching the anime. Because I think you're going to get much of the same experience, but you wouldn't have to endure necessarily the same amount, because I think it is an exhausting series to kind of read through at times, even if you find it hysterical. But I enjoy it. I do like it. It's not going to be for everyone, but comedies rarely are. But it's someone I think you should definitely at least test out and give it a try, see if it fits your taste. And if so, you can keep going at it.
And a lot of people like the English dub, too.
Oh, you mean Steve Bloom plays, like, five different people at once?
Everybody. The English dub is... People like it because it's rinky-dink, because it's bad. Like, it's so bad it turns back around into being funny again. But they don't ruin the emotional moments, necessarily, with how bad it is. It's hard to describe. It's kind of like... It's kind of like a kid's show dub that you have fondness for, like a Digimon or a Pokemon or something like that, where it's like, this is technically too much it's too much for what the original version was doing, but it's still funny. I don't know. And yes, like, Wendy Lee and Steve Bloom play, I think, like, half the characters, and the other half is some other people. So.
Okay. I think that is going to do it. Hope, thank you very much for joining us. So if you want to head out, you can do that. Is there anything you want to plug real quick if you want to?
No, just thanks for having me on. If you want to read more of my, like, writing or something like that, a lot of it goes up on Anime News Network, and it'll be a while, but, like, if you didn't like, support it on Kickstarter, you won't see any results for it for a while. But if you want to check out the demo of the game I'm making, Lovely Little Thieves, that's on Kickstarter. You just Google it and find it. But yeah, like, thanks very much for having me on. It's great to catch up with you guys. And
yes.
Any other thing you want to do, you know, if I can, I guess if I have to read a thing, then or rewatch a thing, then I'd absolutely be down for it. So.
All right, cool. Mm-hmm. All right.
Take care.
Thank you very much. Hope you have a good one.
Later.
Let's do this now.
Now you can start burping again, Nick. She's gone.
All right. Recap portion of Weekly Manga Recap time. We got the big old discussion about music. I just realized something. Is it your turn to pick the next recommendation?
Yeah, I got it.
Okay. I was like,
my god.
I gotta, like, covertly choose the next recommendation in between talking about all this stuff.
No, I gotcha.
It was just something like, wait. Doing a recommendation means we need to do the next one. Let's do the recap portion. Weekly Manga Recap. We have a number of different series to talk about because we have a new Shonen Jump series that just started this week, which hopefully will be sticking around for a while. But in the meantime, let's start off with Black Clover, page 38, the one I've set my heart on. So last time, Chris, I mean, you observed, like, isn't a mixer, like, you know, a dating thing? And I was like, well, not necessarily. Turns out that's what they went to. They went on a trip. They went on a triple date. Asta and Luck tagging along with Finral. Oh no! This name, Finral Rolakase? Rolakase? Rolakas? Rulakase. That there are like 20 different ways you could pronounce that last name.
It's weird because I'd want to just pronounce, like, just call him by his first name, and I'm like, Finral.
I'm pretty sure
Finral.
At least there are fewer different syllables, so there are fewer
ways to
pronounce it.
I'm going to call him Hair Guy.
Winky dude. So, he's brought
He has a sound effect that says Charmed. I'm going to call him Charmy. That's... Even though there's already a Charmy character who I'm now going to retroactively name Food
Finral.
Girl. Yeah, Finral. Just confuse people.
We've got Finral and Luck and Asta on a triple date with these three girls, these three NPCs, basically.
NPCs.
So Finral introduces himself first, and he, like, pulls these flowers out of a portal. He's like, oh, I'm the Black Bull's spatial magic user, and so on. Here, check out these moon blossoms that I just picked. And so he's thinking to himself privately, okay, I've got to get a girlfriend, guys, so in order to do that, you know, I've set the stage for you, so... help me carry on this good impression. And so Luck says, all right, I'm Luck Voltia. I'm 18, and I'm in the Black Bulls. I like fighting tough enemies in bloody Mortal Kombat.
But I like it because he's suave. Fenrir is suave. He's like, yes, I pick these flowers from the mountains that only grow at certain times of the year. Please accept them as my token of friendship. And they're like, oh, that's great. And he's like, all right, guys, you introduce yourselves. And Luck's like, huh, so I just had to talk about what I like. I like murdering people. And Asta's like, well, I guess a guy should talk about his dream, right? Oh, I want to become the Wizard King. And you're like, oh, okay. Asta finally has a humorous admiral trait. He's fucking got no game. None whatsoever.
I like how his dating face is like, not only putting on his glimmering, shiny eyes, but also holding his fist up in front of his face and clenching it so hard that veins are bulging in two different places. It's like, Jesus, dude.
He's dedicated, Nick.
Oh, he's so enthusiastic about the Wizard King thing. But yeah, of course, all three girls are very much kind of like put off by this, and it's like, oh, no. But of course, they can't just be like, oh, these guys have no game. They're like, oh, but they're just from the Black Bull, so they're from the bottom of the heap. And, you know, this guy, he's a peasant. Oh, and geez, he'll never be the Wizard King. They have to do it the same way that every NPC in Black Clover does everything related to fucking Asta. All the time, this is what happens to him. You could have just said, like, wow, this guy is a fucking weirdo. But no, like, there's no way he'll be Wizard King, this delusional peasant. Every single time. Anyway, so they talk about themselves for a little bit. They've got, you know, like, oh, I work at a dressmaker's, I work as a hairdresser, and the last girl, Rebecca, works at a restaurant. And so Finral is getting nervous about everything. He's trying to be like, oh, you know, I want to hear about your work. And they're like, no, tell us about your job as in the Magic Knights and stuff. I'm sure you've got all sorts of cool stories. And so Finral says, okay, yeah, Luck, what have you done lately? Well, the other day I slaughtered a group of bandits.
And it's implied that he is telling this to them in graphic detail because there's a shot of him fighting people, but a lot of the details are blurred out, like a nip slip just happened or something like that. Like, it just had to be censored.
And I should also clarify, I say, like, I slaughtered a group of 10 bandits, but he's saying, like, oh, the other day I slaughtered a group of 10 bandits. It was so fun.
And it's like, he's like, that was great. And he's, like, shooting electricity between his hands as he does it.
And then, I believe it's Finral tries to...
Finral's like, this is a dead angle.
You'll have to forgive me. Finral and Luck have very similarly drawn hair. And so when they're drawn from the back, they look very similar. Anyway, but yeah, Finral's like, oh, God, I gotta change the subject. Asta, you got commended by the Wizard King recently. And I was like, yeah, I helped to drive off some awful people. But I really got beaten up. And he, like, lifts his shirt up to expose his recent stomach wounds.
The wounds that they were told that if he trained would kill him, so you have to imagine they're pretty graphic.
Right, they're still not fully healed yet, and apparently aren't covered in bandages, or at the very least have blood staining the bandages. So Fenrir's like, God damn it. I guess it was a really bad idea going with these guys. But if I went with any of the others, they would fuck it up too. So now, there's no one who can help beat me, who will be my wingman.
I'm trying to see, and I know Magnus Wing. We know why he'd be wrong, because he's an idiot. Right. And I can assume why Yami's just too serious of a guy. I guess that guy in the middle who looks like he's wearing lipstick with a police hat on, like a Marilyn Manson police officer, is that Gray? Like, maybe that's what Gray's natural appearance is?
No, that's Gordon.
Gordon? I don't remember Gordon at all. And then I don't know who the
Gray
sister guy is.
Gray is the one where you can't tell which one.
Oh, so it's just a question mark. Okay.
Gaush, we haven't been introduced to any of these three guys in full detail yet, but Gaush, we did get that thing about how he's obsessed with his sister.
Okay. Fair enough. But I do like him being like, these were the best choices I had. I kind of feel bad for this dude. He's like, I'm the one non-freak in my guild.
I'm the only guy who wants to get with the girl.
I just want to get laid. I don't even need to get laid. I just want to have a good date. And the only two people I can invite along are a sociopath and a fucking loser.
Who won't shut up about the Wizard King.
It's like, I had two people to bring with me on this day. Nick, it'd be like if you were The Rock, with all the physical appearance and charisma of him, and you're like, my only two options to bring on this date with me are fucking Marilyn Manson, or not, Charles Manson, rather, and Chris, like, with no game, who can't talk to somebody without being like, check out my weird scars.
You know, here I thought you were just going to bring up Mankind. Mankind, tell the girls what you did recently. Well, I got in a feud with Triple H and he tried to beat me with the chair until my brains were spilling out of my ear. Stop talking about that shit. The Rock's trying to get some pie over here. Oh, it's right there on the menu, Rock. No, goddammit!
Talking about vagina! Can't say that on television. It's before 9.
So anyway, this is going on, and suddenly Noelle walks by. She's a bar wench all of a sudden. She has temporarily gotten a job at this restaurant, is working as a barmaid slash waitress, and she literally was just like, is so Sindre over Asta that she had to secretly follow him to his date to see how things were going. Now, in concept, this is fucking stupid and terrible. In execution, she has the funniest lines in this chapter.
She's hilarious in this chapter.
Because, like, people keep on coming up to her like, hey, girl, give me a beer. Just like, get it yourself, you fucking insect.
Well, that's the thing. Like, when this character was Noelle's first introduced into the series, she was, like, the hoity-toity, like, elitist who was always just like, oh, this peasant has joined the Black Bullseye? Never! And then she softened, you know, they defrosted the Ice Queen, and since then she's just been kind of friendly, but it's funny to see in this chapter she's kind of gone back to it a little bit. She's like, hey, give me a beer. Pour it yourself, bitch. Shouldn't say bitch, but...
Well, she calls him an insect.
Yeah, she's like, insect. Look at this, that glare.
Then, meanwhile, other stuff's going on. Sek, that one guy who keeps on running into Asta and having bad stuff go on, he is taking credit for running off the invading forces and stuff while attending his own triple date with these two random losers. Fortunately, the three girls that he's trying to impress are not buying it either. And eventually, Sek just... Noelle just gets so sick of Sek being himself that when he finally is like, oh, waitress, another drink, she actually takes out her wand and blasts him with a blast of water.
Pretty great.
I love Noelle, seriously. And actually, meanwhile, over at Asta's triple date, things are actually going pretty well with Luck and with Finral. Finral. Because Finral's, you know, Finral's got game, and Luck is actually, like, really interested in the hairdresser girl. It's like, oh, well, you know, why don't you show me your magic and stuff? She's like, oh, I don't know. And she's kind of like, oh, he's kind of like this friendly bad boy, and so on and so forth. So they're actually, things are going off pretty well between the four of them. Meanwhile, Asta and Rebecca, the third girl, have, like, nothing to talk about. And his small talk is terrible. And eventually she's just like, no, I can't do this. Like, I was, my friend said I should go and I should try to find a guy so that, you know, he can help me with my siblings, but I don't know if I can do this. This isn't really me. And Asta's like, oh, you've got siblings. And he, you know, talks about the kids back at the orphanage that he basically considered his own siblings. And they really bond over how much they care about the brother-sister characters in their life. Which, of course, pisses Noelle off, and she breaks one of the plates that she's holding. And then when her boss gets mad at her, she tells him to shut up.
I love that she's... Not only is she mean to the customers, she's mean to her boss as well.
This cares nothing about... She got the job for one reason, and she cares nothing about how well she performs it.
I like to think that when she got the job, she's like, wait, there are sides to your skirt? What is this? I didn't know a skirt could have four sides.
So this drunk guy shows up, and he is like, oh, this is a pretty girl. Wait, I recognize you. You're from the local restaurant. You're that chick who's got the little kid carried around on her back all the time. Oh, these brats are kids. You should come up with me and fuck. And then ask
Nick, please. This is a child. This is a series for children. He's not going to have sex with her.
Come play with
He's
me.
He's going to have one romantic kiss with her, I believe.
So he like puts his hand on her shoulder, and she's like, "No, let go of me." And Asta, with his superhuman strength, you know, grabs the guy by the arm and like lifts him up into the air and slams him down to the floor and says, "You know, don't judge people based on appearances. You don't know anything about this lady." This, of course, causes a bar fight to start to break out. Asta grabs Rebecca and runs off. Meanwhile, Noelle is like, "Manager, I quit. Bye."
Yeah, he's going out later.
So Rebecca and Asta catch up in the alleyway, and Rebecca's like, "Hey, Asta, is there somebody you like?" And he's like, "Yes, there's somebody I've set my heart on." Twinkle eyes. And Noelle is like, oh, "He does?" And she like crouches around behind the corner, and she's like, "It couldn't be me." Good. And so Rebecca says, "Okay, well, you know, you can come over sometime. I'll see you later." And meanwhile, as Noelle is having her freak out, Asta's like, "Ah, sister," the nun from the start of the series. "I'm gonna come and get you when I become the Wizard King."
I actually legitimately found this very funny, the idea. He's like, "Yeah, I do have my heart set on someone," and Noelle just like has like a Sundare moment where she's like, "Oh my god, he must be me," and then you cut away and he's like still pining over the fucking sister who just did not give less of a fuck about him romantically at the start of the series. I actually thought that was a funny joke and a good callback to chapter one.
I was impressed by that. Actually, you know, calling back to Asta's roots and stuff was a nice development in this chapter, reminding, hey, this is kind of what part of what drives Asta. Remember that. Of course, at the end of it, Rebecca is like, "Just because I'm rooting for you doesn't mean I'm giving up." So Asta's got a third person who's attracted to
you. All right, hold on. I do need to be a douche and come in on this. I've seen it from a lot of people in the chat room. I really don't feel like Rebecca's actually a love interest. I feel like this is a character who we may never see again. Like, I feel like this was a one-off joke chapter.
But seriously, like, every important female character, it seems like, has been attracted to Asta or attracted to Yuno.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, it's fine if that's, you know, that's the way they're kind of going with it. I just don't feel like, I feel like people were trying to get really angry about this, being like, "Oh, another girl falls for him." Like, it's a, like, chapter I don't think it's ever really going to have an impact yet. It'd be like getting angry that the kid in Naruto from the bridge arc with Zabuza was like, "Oh, he likes Naruto now?" I'm like, "Yeah, but we're never going to see this fucking kid again." I think he already had Konohamaru. I'm like, he's not going to see this fucking kid again.
I'm just kind of getting sick of it because it seems like every female character has done that. Like, there's literally, like, not Kana, I think, so far, it has been, like, the one female character introduced who has not wound up having a crush on the two of them. It's getting a little tiring that it just happens with every single one of them, is my point.
I can see that. But I like this character. I liked what we actually got out of this chapter from Asta. I liked his, you know, throwing that guy. I know, you know, I liked it because he's like, you know, "Don't judge her. You don't know anything about her." It was almost kind of like a, you know, a insight more about her, really, you know, just assuming that she has some sort of, you know, thinking about her in a derogatory way when he's like, "You don't know anything about this person, so don't talk shit about her." Like, I like that message, I like that sentiment. So it's a moment where I'm actually supporting Asta. I'm like, good, you know. I think Asta's probably better when he's not needing to defend himself. I think he works a lot better when he's defending other people, and he can relate to them being somebody who's had to work hard to kind of gain and earn his own perception, you know,
right,
the way people see him. So I legitimately, for the most part, really enjoyed this chapter.
I was very entertained by it.
Very funny chapter. I liked kind of gain a little bit of a glimpse of some of these other characters. I liked seeing Noelle in a very humorous situation. And I just enjoyed all the way around. I really thought this was a good chapter. I don't think this is necessarily, as I know some people have been like, is this the turning point? I can't say. I think this is a chapter that has almost no consequence on the rest of the series going forward. I just thought this was a very funny
chapter.
Just
you wait, Chris. Rebecca's going to be the new Fiona.
I'm like, did not see this one coming. She has like 8 kids, brothers and sisters to take care of, and I don't know if she even has magic. She has the other type of void magic. I'm like, wow. That's awful. Before we get to Bleach, though, Nick, we need to note, for those of you who are watching this right now, we're now streaming through Hitbox. And as mentioned last week, Nick is adding a new element to the show where every week we're going to give our best series. And Nick's going to tally that up and keep a tracker for it. If you are in the chat room of Hitbox, hitbox.tv/WorldOT, a poll is currently up. It's currently running. It'll be running throughout the episode, where you could vote for it. I'm only mentioning this because I know we have a lot of people watching right now, not as many votes as there probably could be, so feel free to put your vote in. I have basically every series we're going to talk about this week, including Isekai, which we're not going to be talking about, at least I wasn't planning to, there. So you can vote for anyone you want, and at the end of it, it's going to be tracked in our thing for the rest of the however long we're tracking it. So make sure you put your vote in for what you think the best series was.
Okay. That's it. Let's now move on to Bleach, which we're on. What chapter are we on? 651. The Theater Suicide Scene 5. Last time resorting to extreme measures, Nanao demanded that Shunsui release her, Zanpakuto, so that she could help him in the fight against super weird owl monster Lilibaro. This guy used to be a guy with a sniper rifle. Remember that, guys. So we get a kind of... Well, it's a very short flashback. With just a young Shunsui as he wakes up and is greeted by the sight of a woman who looks very much like Nanao. It's Nanao's mother, obviously.
And, is it? It looks like Munahana.
Who's dead, never coming back. Anyway.
I wasn't saying you up for that. It literally looks like Munahana.
Well, that's because Kubo does...
I think it's the hairstyle, I think.
A lot of Kubo's characters look very similar. Like, Rukia and Hitsugaya look way more similar than they should, honestly. Anyway, so Shunsui refers to her as his sister-in-law. Okay. Anyway, cut back to the present, and Lilibaro, like, I don't know exactly what he does. He stretches his head out.
Yes.
So that's... I don't know how this is supposed to improve his ability to see them.
Well, no, he grows... It seems like he grows eyes, so he stretches out his head, and then... I don't know, maybe he just shifts the eyes around. Basically, he makes his head into a big flat disc and, I guess, moves the eyes around the perimeter of it to see better. I thought he grew eyes, but I guess I don't actually see eyes appearing, so maybe he doesn't.
So, he looks around and he sees this...
What odd power for an owl to have, or whatever he is.
He eventually catches sight of this one shadow, and he's like, ah, you're using the Kageyoni to stay in the shadows hidden from me. All right, then, I'll make the shadow disappear from the ground! He just summons this giant orb of light, but because he summons it beneath himself, this causes the shadow to appear because his beak casts a shadow on his face. So suddenly, Nanao sprouts up from his beak shadow, and... Then we cut to the flashback to explain what happened while they were stuck in the shadow and hiding. And basically, and I was like, what's going on? I mean, alright, you've got Katen Kyokatsu. You can separate it into Katen and Kyokatsu when you release it, but apparently Kyokatsu is my Zanpakuto. And Shunsui's like, well, sort of. You see, Ohana gave birth to Okyo to hide your Zanpakuto. Remember, Ohana is his Zanpakuto. His sword gave birth to something. Seemingly, this means that Katen is Kyokatsu's mother. Zanpakuto's gonna give birth. This is weird. There is so much information in this chapter to process. I can't get caught now. And so Shunsui explains, okay, the Issei family has only women in it. Only women are born into it. So they, you know, will adopt sons-in-law into the family. But it's said that there's this curse that kills all men who marry into the Issei family. They die early on. Your mother said the curse was ridiculous. So she married into a different family to dispel the curse, knowing she'd be cutting off the Issei bloodline. But in the end, her husband too died. And he explains, and also, you know, the man she married was my older brother. So that's how we're related, basically. I'm your uncle, essentially. And he says, like, oh, you know, when your mother married my brother, we started to get along better. And I would visit them often and so on and so forth. And so it's not uncommon, you know, when aristocratic families lose a son for them to cut ties and, you know, with the widow and send her back to her own family. But she left her family prepared to never return. And in the end, she couldn't escape them. An Issei woman cannot escape the Issei family or the Issei curse after all. And it may be because of this sword. She was determined to keep the daughter she was expecting away from the curse. So I took the sword and had Okyo, who was fond of hide and seek, hide it. That being Kyokatsu. So Kyokatsu then takes the sword, and what does she do? She reaches into her own mask. Okay, yeah. That's what happens.
Yeah.
She, like, because her mask is hiding her face, and she reaches into it as if it's like a shadow, and she pulls this package out of it, and that's the Issei family sword. So now back in the present, the weapon is revealed, essentially, as now, like, it, again, it goes into the flashback to say, I know you don't really want me to have this sword, but, you know, my mother said that she wanted to, you know, rid herself of the curse, but I'm making the decision to instead bear the burden of it in full. And, you know, even if I am cursed, I don't think that I would, and I'm sure that the man I admire wouldn't think that the curse would be anything other than ridiculous. I have a feeling he's the kind of person who would simply laugh it off. From what I understand, this could be interpreted as meaning that Nanao's got a crush on her uncle.
It's something that I feel like I'd really have to understand the Japanese version of it. The language here says the man I admire, which doesn't necessarily mean it. It's meant to imply that the Issei curse affects somebody, like a man in a Issei's life that means a lot to them, usually their husband or whatever. In this case, since she doesn't actually have a significant other, it could be, you know, Shunsui, who's essentially her mentor, her leader, you know, her partner. So I wouldn't look at it immediately and be like, ew. It does have the possibility for that context, and that could just be like a way of translating it to avoid any specific language, to be like, yeah, the uncle I'd like to fuck would think a curse like that's ridiculous. And something like that, that would be weird. But I choose to go with the language used here and believe that she's just saying, I admire Shunsui a lot, and I believe that you would not be
you would
superstitious
think
of this. You wouldn't think this would legitimately be a danger to us.
Okay. So then we get more explanation about what the Issei family do. They are a family of priests, and they administer rituals and do not individually own Zanpakuto. Instead, a single Zanpakuto is inherited by the head of the family from generation to generation, is a sword without an edge used for rituals, and it cannot be used to cut people down. It's believed to have the power to go face to face with God, receive God's power, and disperse it in all directions. There's so much information in this chapter.
There's a lot.
Let's go over this really quickly, okay? We learned in the last one that Nanao's sword was part of what we thought was Shunsui's Zanpakuto, and it somehow been sealed. We learned in this chapter that Nanao and Shunsui are related because Nanao's mother had married Shunsui's brother. Then we find out Nanao's family is cursed, and to have all, they're basically a Gerudo family, essentially. Then we find out that the reason Nanao does not have a Zanpakuto and has not had one is because it's passed from generation to generation the way that no other Zanpakuto is. Then we find out it has the power to take on a god. Oh my god, freaking, I hate Kubo info dumps so much. What the fuck?
Nick, It's Shinken Hakuyokin. Look at it. It's so cool looking.
It does look really cool, I'll admit.
It does, actually.
It does look... That is a badass picture where, you know, her holding it at the ready in order to take on Lilibara at the end of the chapter. It is cool. But what the fuck did we know about Nanao before this chapter, really?
She had a book.
She was this put-upon, basically, manager of the 8th Division that had to do all of the captain's paperwork because he's a lazy asshole and she's serious about her job. That's all we knew about her. We didn't really know about the relationship between the two, except it was complicated. We didn't know about any of the things that she had done to become a Soul Reaper, and so all of a sudden, we're supposed to be like, oh, so she became a Soul Reaper because this, and this. Okay, now I care about her to take on Lilibara and stuff. It's like, what? But she's been around for like 600 chapters, though. Shouldn't I already be caring about her without this flashback to... I don't like Bleach.
The only question I... Because here's the thing. I actually like this chapter, and I'll give you a couple reasons why, but the only real huge question I have to this is like, how did she get to be Vice Lieutenant if she didn't even have a Zanpakutai?
I don't know.
I feel like at some point that requirement... I mean, like, Mayuri, you could at least be like, well, he's a freak. No one wanted to tell him no. Like, you can't make this monster as your lieutenant.
But and also,
I feel like someone in the 8th Division would be like, all right, like the 4th season, like, this is bullshit. I at least have a sword and have been fighting and training with it.
And also, like, you know, you could say, like, oh, but, well, Yachiru, that's favoritism on Soraki's part. Well, no, Yachiru is actually legitimately scary and would kick a bunch of people's asses, so there's that.
Yeah.
The only comparison, actually, I can think of to make would be, like, Ukitake not having a vice captain for a really long time after Kaien died. And that was because, like, oh, you know, because, he died and I don't want a replacement, so on and so forth. It's like, well, why not? Because I'm, like, the third most important captain. Shut up. That's why.
But, I mean, ultimately, I didn't mind this chapter. Here's the big reason, Nick. You've brought up a lot of very valid points, and I know a lot of people in the chat are bringing them up, as to how this really fits in with, like, the logic and canon we've come to understand of Bleach. I have officially come to a place now where I have said, I do not care if this makes no sense. I am just enjoying the story as it is, and I thought this was a good piece for Nanao and Shunsui to develop them a little bit. And I'm glad she is getting development by the end of the series. I enjoy that fact. For the longest time, I was going to be right there with you, being like, this doesn't make any sense, there's huge problems. And I've come to realize that I don't have those same problems, because I realize the things that I wanted to get out of Bleach are never going to be answered. And I realized this, I was in touch with a friend of mine. I told you about my friend Frank, right? The one who got me into manga. He still reads manga, but on a very small basis. Like, he doesn't listen to this podcast. He doesn't read manga when they come out weekly. He usually waits a very long time. And I think at this point, he stopped reading Bleach altogether. He's very much a casual fan. But he sent me an email about his thoughts on Bleach. I just want to read it for you. So from this point forward, it's verbatim. Quote, "The thing that always bothered me about Bleach, aside from the total lack of narrative structure besides here's a new villain, hit it with your sword, was that there were so many bigger questions that are raised and then totally ignored. Like, we spend the first volume or two getting to have some sympathy for Ghost. Orihime's brother gets purified, and both the hearts get healed in the process. Then we get plot points like, hey, I'm the Quincy. No matter what your story was before you became a hollow, I'm going to eradicate you from existence. If I met Orihime's brother, there'd be no tearful reunion, just the sweet embrace of oblivion. Who knows how many other worthwhile souls I've destroyed in my endless series of forgettable battles. Then, the boy in the parakeet from the first volume just doesn't want anybody to get hurt. He just misses his mom. Then we find out, hey, you know that peaceful place we promised you before Kanso? Well, you're actually going to be stuck in an eternal caste system where there's no food or water, which you apparently need as a ghost, and brigands are everywhere. All of us Soul Reapers escaped that horrible place by agreeing to become hired swords. Have fun! Oh, and you'll never see your mom again. It's not enough that he writes bad plots. He's creating a cruel universe and totally ignoring the ramifications of his actions." I just, like, it was like,
that's... I'm very sad now.
I was like, he nailed it. That's always been the biggest thing that bothered me. I was like, no one's ever going to address the fact that Quint's, like, the major crux of the conflict in Bleach for a long time was like, yeah, Quincy's are, like, eradicating souls from existence, and it really fucks with the reincarnation aspect.
Well,
and
I just brought up at the beginning of the arc, remember when Mayuri, like, rounded up a bunch of souls and killed them. Because apparently that actually offsets the imbalance that the Quincy's were responsible for, even though they killed... I don't know exactly how it was supposed to work. But they didn't bring up Quincy's annihilate, you know, souls and stuff, and that's really bad. That's why we ended up committing genocide against them.
Yeah. But it's like one of those things where, like, oh, the moral question was never really addressed. And after I've come to accept, like, it's just not going to be addressed. And all these questions, like, why do souls need food and water? Why is there a caste system? Like, how do these people get here? All those questions. When I'm like, these aren't ever going to be answered, and more questions will likely pile on top of them. I've just accepted they won't be there anymore, and I'm just going to take Bleach at face value from this point.
You know, come to think of it, I think that I would be enjoying this arc a lot more if there was more focus on why it was so important to defeat the Quincy's. Because, you know, the universe is in danger if they win, basically.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, they've gotten that whole thing where it's like, well, Geobox's going to remake the whole world in his image and stuff, but it was, before that, it was just like, well, it's the Soul Society versus the Quincy, and that's about it.
Yeah, it was always that logic of like, well, you gotta stop the Quincy's because they'll destroy reality, but it's like, well, they're gonna, also, they're all weirdos and stuff like that.
I mean, they started going down that path, and they just didn't really follow up on it.
Huh? Yeah. But no, I actually, for the most part, I did not mind this chapter. And clearly I'm not alone. There are three people who voted for this favorite chapter this week.
I think that in terms of, like, recent Bleach chapters that we've gotten, this was actually, like, pretty good. But yeah, still, just like, oh my god, there's so much information to get through. God damn it.
And I'm also like, holy shit, this fight is still not over yet. And might not necessarily be completely over next week.
Alright. Let us move on to the newest Jumpstart series, Buddy Strike. Chapter 1, The Legendary Grim Reaper. It's a new sports manga by Kaito, focusing on baseball. There have been so many baseball manga. Like, seriously. But, I mean...
Are they all about the pitcher-catcher relationship?
I don't really know. I mean, there are so many. There might be a ton about the battery relationship. Basically, yeah, we get this opening page. It's all about how, you know, pitchers form a battery with a catcher. You know, they team with a catcher and they have this relationship with them. And then that way, you know, if they make one with this catcher, they gain supreme power. But they have to be careful because he will consume their soul. And he is known as the Grim Reaper. Suddenly, baseball is awesome, basically.
Yeah.
So we get introduced to our protagonist, who is a pitcher named... what is his name? Arakami. I almost said Arakawa, but that's the mangaka, I think. And so he is technically a really talented pitcher because he can throw an amazing fastball, but he has no control over it, and no catcher can seemingly handle his pitches and so on and so forth. And so, despite the fact that he has all this throwing power, he can apparently throw an 87-mile-per-hour fastball, despite only being at the end of middle school, and he's going to be in high school next year. He is a loser, essentially. And so he gets bullied by this one guy named Kitakata, who is this awesome batter and so on and so forth, and he mocks him by saying, he's like, you know, you got all this throwing power, but come on, you haven't been able to actually use your fastball. Effectively, you're the king of self-destruction. You walk people at a 70% rate. That is a really bad rate for you who do not know. And he even says, like, the last game you were in, you gave up 30 runs without the other team having to actually swing their bats, which is absolutely fucking insane. Like, why was this guy not pulled? Apparently they had no backup pitcher.
Yeah, I was like, how did this dude keep getting... As I mentioned, like, your last pitcher sucked. I was like, so this implies this happened more than once? Like, did no one ever be like, hey, you know this dude who just, like, only walks people because his pitches go wild? Maybe we shouldn't play him anymore.
So he goes out and vents his frustrations. He's trying to knock a can down with his pitch, and he can't actually hit it most of the time. And so there's this guy he's kind of hanging out with, who's his friend. I forget what his name is, but he's not as important a character. So forgive me on that one for not getting it yet.
And I like how the guy... Smedgy.
Well, Keigo, I guess. Keigo says, you know, you could just kick his ass. And he's like, no, Keigo, I've got to beat him with baseball or it's no points. Which, first off, I like how he's got a friend just like, just beat him up. And I also like how he's like, no, I've got to beat him at baseball. That's the only point there. So, admirable protagonist and also a funny, no-nonsense friend, too. And so eventually Keigo's like, alright, well, there is a way you can beat him with baseball. You could team up with this catcher who's known as the Grim Reaper. And so the guy's like, so You mean you form a battery with them and then you die at the end? What, so you believe that? No! Well, why are you so scared? And so on. And so he's like, oh, you know, there's all this stuff that people say about him. They say he's got a skull-shaped birthmark on his right hand, and so on and so forth. And then he heads off to go home, and Arakami is, you know, kind of still bummed out, thinking about how he let his, you know, his baseball team down, and thinking about how he's mocked for not being out of control over his pitches and stuff. And he says, oh man, if a guy like that really did exist, I'd gladly give him my soul. And right on cue, somebody from up above says, oh really? And he's been watching Arakami for seemingly a very long time. And he jumps down from his perch and he says, hey, I'm the legendary Grim Reaper that, you know, you've been talking about. And it's weird because Arakami for saying is just like, what are you talking about? Well, it's the thing you were just talking about. And eventually the guy just gets so frustrated with him not understanding him, they just, like, he grows this, like, Dragon Ball Z power aura and jumps down to confront him over how stupid he is. Yeah. So he's this short little guy, and Arakami's like, staring at him because he's so short, and he's like, oh, I can tell, you're thinking he's small, aren't you? No, 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 no! I think you're actually really big for a great schooler. And he gets really mad because he's actually the same age as Arakami.
And he rocket headbutt missiles him.
Yeah. The Grim Reaper, his name isn't given yet, and he says, the reason your pitches don't end up in the catcher's mitt, do you want to know why? It's because your catcher sucked. And from this point on, the Grim Reaper has a lot of really good facial expressions. Just these weird, cartoonish, silly facial expressions that really make his more comedic lines work better. Just a lot of the times, like, his nose just doesn't get drawn because he's so silly looking. Anyway, so he says, like, look, you know, that guy who was your catcher before, your friend, you think he's your friend and stuff, but, you know, he kept on letting balls go by, and when he could have caught them, those turned into wild pitches. Strikes turned to balls because his technical skills aren't good enough, and he's not calling timeouts to give you directions. He's not helping you out during the course of the game. He's got no right to call himself a catcher. And also, he has no interest in trying to secure your soul, so what the fuck's wrong with him? So he explains, like, look, you know, what I mean is, a pitcher must put his body and soul into each throw. When going up against the batter, a pitcher releases a condensed form of his fighting spirit to take down a batter. In other words, it's an incarnation of a pitcher's soul. And he who faces it head on and takes it in is a catcher. And he takes off his mitt and holds up his right hand. And there is a really awesome looking birthmark of a skull on his
hand. That is so, it's almost a ridiculous kind of like birthmark. Like, that is very specific.
I mean, it looks like it was burned on. More than it is a birthmark. And it's like, it's so ridiculous how much like a skull it looks like. Because like it takes up most things of his hand. It's not like a little dot that looks like a skull. It is a full-on drawing of like a third of a skull that goes from his middle finger to his pinky and all the way back to his wrist.
Apparently it's a burn. Legitimately. Because I'm like, it's a very specific birthmark. And like, it even has little indents to show the teeth.
Yeah, he says, like, it's just an old burn scar. But I mean, like, it's ridiculous, but I think it looks so fucking cool, honestly. I can't help it. So, yeah, he's like, you know, with this hand, you know, I can take in any soul, so you throw your best pitches, and I'll catch them. And he's like, you know, come on, team up with me, we'll be an invincible combination, essentially. And Arakami's like, why? He's like, what do you mean? We've never met before, so... What, and also, I mean, like, why do you know so much about me? He doesn't answer or anything. And so he's like, why are you being quiet? Why aren't you telling me anything? He's like, I'm not going to tell you. I'm just not going to tell you. So join up with me for now. And so Arkham's like, this guy is really creepy. So, no. Of course I'm not going to give you my soul. What the fuck are you talking about? I don't know, you know who you are. So, yeah, he basically just leaves him behind and he says, you know, that my friend who you criticized, you know, maybe he does suck at baseball, but he's a good guy, and he helps me with practice, even though he can't keep up with me. That's how he ends up with all those bruises on his chest and stuff. It's my fault, and, you know, he wasted all that effort because we didn't win. So, yeah, I mean, you want me to just, like, switch catchers all of a sudden so I can start winning? You know, get lost, you know, it's that's not fair, basically. So it's interesting because, like, you know, you said this thing where it's like, I get where both of them are coming from, basically. One of them says, like, this is how you're supposed to, how you've got to win. You know, you've got to have someone who can catch your ridiculous fastballs. And he's like, well, no, that would be betraying my friend, essentially. And the other guy's like, no, that's also not fair if you just stick with him just because he's your friend. That's not being fair to him. And also, you're like, you know, you're underestimating how important catchers are if you do that. And then he leaves it by basically getting up in his face about it. And then he's like, all right, bye. And he makes a weird face. So Arakami is left to himself the next day, and Kitakata basically starts causing shit because the Grim Reaper shows up to Arakami's school and is like, hey, you're a terrible baseball player, so Kitakata and his friend start beating him up. So that draws Arakami's attention because his friend tells him about it. He goes out to see what's going on, and the Grim Reaper is still trash-talking him, even as he's getting punched in the face over and over again. And Arakami's like, what the fuck are you doing? And finally, actually, there is a cool little moment where, like, Arakami's rushing to save him, and before he does, the Grim Reaper says, hey, pitchers shouldn't punch what they're throwing in. So instead he does a flying kick. So, that's cool. And so Arakami's like, hey, you know, stop beating that guy up, and the Grim Reaper says, we will have a pitching battle! He's like, what are you talking about? Look, if we win with a strike down the middle during that one at bat, you know, we'll lose if we don't get a strike down the middle. If you get a hit, if you get a walk, if you get a foul, even three strikes that aren't down the middle, you know, we'll lose. But if we get three strikes, we win. How's that? And he makes a weird face. His faces are so weird.
It's very, very active in his facial expressions.
So Kitakata's like, well, you're absolutely insane, so, and there's no way I'll lose because, you know, Arakami's terrible. So fine, we'll do that. And Arakami's all pissed off because, like, what have you gotten us into, essentially? But the Grim Reaper just says, look, just, you know, throw the ball like you want to kill me. Trust me on this, all right? I'll catch every single ball that you throw at me. I won't drop it. I won't evade it. I'm not going to get hurt. So throw it with all your might. Don't worry about hitting me. Throw it like it's a special beam cannon. What a weird random Dragon Ball Z reference.
It's kind of funny.
And Arakami brings up something that's interesting, which is, shouldn't I want to kill Kitakata? And the Grim Reaper says, that's why you're an idiot with no control. No, you're supposed to be aiming at my glove. Don't bother thinking about the batter. Just focus on where my mitt is. Don't take your eyes off of it. And Arakami's like, "What? Okay, seriously, why are you doing this for me? And he says, look, I want to make you into the best pitcher that the Kokushin has ever seen. So, again, mostly keeping his motivations to himself. For the time being, so we can find out more about him in the future. So Arakami, you know, gets ready to pitch, and he stares down the Grim Reaper in this really awesome full-page spread that he's just, like, staring really intensely at him, surrounded by this giant aura. And Arakami again remembers what he says, like, okay, yeah, Kitakata in this case is not my opponent. I've got to actually square off against him. But he's really confused. He's like, well, isn't he kind of my teammate, though? So he throws his first pitch and he's like, alright, fine, try and catch this. It goes absurdly high, because, you know, in true Arakami form, basically, he's got no control, but the Grim Reaper snaps his glove back over his shoulder in order to catch it and just snatches it out of the air and immediately tosses it back to Arakami. And the Grim Reaper's like, oh yeah, nice crappy pitch, good job. But that bit, you know, reassures Arakami, because, like, you know, I've always been afraid that I'm going to hurt someone with my pitching, but the more
careful... He's like the Hulk, Nick!
Yeah, really, he's like, yeah, but then he says, the more carefully that I threw the ball to avoid hurting people, the more I would miss the mitt. And so that's been what the Grim Reaper's been trying to tell him, is just, like, you know, just throw everything you've got and trust me to catch it. Don't have so much self-doubt and stuff. And Arakami realized from all this, you know, you can't play baseball by yourself. But with two, you can win. And there's this big old two-page spread of him throwing his next pitch, and it slams right into the Grim Reaper's glove, right down the plate, and Kitakata has swung and missed it.
I would like to note, though, Nick, you can play baseball by yourself. That was actually the premise of the great Arthur Miller play, The Man Who Had All the Luck. Turns out he didn't have all the luck in the world after all. He was never going to be a professional baseball player. It's really sad, like all of Arthur Miller's plays.
It is also the premise of that one Bugs Bunny cartoon where he plays for the entire team and wins.
Yeah. Good job, so, Bugs.
Come on, Arakami, just turn into Bugs Bunny.
Yeah. Or Arthur Miller, be sad.
So, we get a bit of narrations like, oh, that was the sound of the beginning. The motionless mitt was able to take it in. And I realized I hadn't yet asked him yet. And Arakami says, what's your name? And the Grim Reaper answers, Kaname Ado. And that's how he came to be my partner, the Grim Reaper that devours pitchers' souls. That's the end of the first chapter.
I love Kaito's artwork. It's incredible in this chapter. There's particularly like the shot of Ado catching the ball in like a big 2-page spread. Really, just so much detail in it. His paneling's great, dynamic backgrounds, really great facial expressions. Kaito is legitimately still one of the best artists in the magazine. This chapter did really speak to me very much, though. I feel like there's like something missing in this series that would really push it over the top and make it a really interesting series. As it is, it's like, it's a baseball manga, but that's about it. Like, it has a unique premise of the catcher pitcher.
Well, like, compare it to like what the opening of Cross Badge was, which was Sakurai, you know, didn't really want to do anything, and Takagawa, you know, I feel like I'm getting her name wrong, I'm sorry. Anyway, it was about you know, how they had these conflicting relationships, and you know, it was about kind of discovering what was weird about them, essentially, and what motivated one to keep on going while the other one was in this kind of downward spiral up until he discovered something that he wanted to do with his life. This one is baseball. It's baseball. Every single motivation in this is linked just to baseball. It is a little bit too sports, essentially. Now,
it just feels very straightforward, which isn't necessarily a problem.
Right. That doesn't mean that it's not going to grow in the future and have more, you know, more interesting characters, and you know, their backstories and stuff could be more beyond that. But it is much more of a traditional sports manga, clearly, than Cross Manage was, and that may end up playing into its favor. This, you know, could very easily, more easily catch on because it's, you know, it's about more popular sports and it's more traditional, focusing on the primary athletes than on a manager and stuff. I don't know. And I'm not going to say it's like, oh, you know, this is not going to be as good as Cross Manage was because it's the first chapter. This was very much just like, oh, Kaito's got a sports manga and look at his artwork and stuff and so on. That was what I was feeling while going through this. It is such a cool looking first chapter.
I think my favorite thing about it is potentially what we will get, where it seems like they're building up this idea that there's going to be a very interesting relationship between Ido and the pitcher. Because they make a note, like, this is the pitcher, the Grim Reaper steals his pitcher's souls. So I don't think it's just these, like, oh, well, I fixed your fastball, and now there's nothing else. Like, it seems to be like there's going to be a very aggressive relationship between the two.
And he's going to, really, like, wear him out or something.
Yeah, he's really going to tear him down to bring the best out of him. So I think that might be the interesting aspect. I hope it keeps going. We'll get two more chapters of it in English Jump. I don't know if the reception to it has been great enough yet that it'll stick around. But if this is a series you do like, make sure you vote for it in the issue survey, community survey. Click that there and vote for it. Let them know that you like the series, and that's the best chance it has of keeping it sticking around. So there you go. Move on then to Fairy Tail, chapter 462, Battlefield, which I might blow through a little bit quickly just because we're getting a little bit behind on time. But essentially, at the start, there's a little bit about the other guilds coming into it, how Mavis doesn't want them to be in, and Luxus is like the one guy who's like, yeah, we kind of need those guys. But he does note that he wants to fight Wall because he's the one who did what, basically took out Freed, Ever, and Mixlow.
Now let's dedicate about 4 pages to Brandish's butt.
Yeah, well, they cut away to Brandish being held in prison, and they have, like, magic nullifying handcuffs on her, and because she was arrested in her bikini, she's in it now, which is fine. It's just like I've gotten used to Bleach not being able to explain things. I really have to just, at this point, accept Fairy Tail's ridiculous fan service. So yes, of course she's in her bikini that doesn't even actually cover up her entire butt. The only thing that's weird is that those two old guys in the guild are talking about manipulating her into sexier poses until someone comes by and punches them in the back of the head. Like, yeah, what are you guys doing? That was so weird.
You're supposed to be part of the good guys, you assholes.
Yeah, you guys were just making a deal about how you're the good guys because you're not killing this character. But you're like, oh, let's spread her legs, and it's like, ew. But no, Lucy comes up and talks to Brandish because she wants to know about, you know, why do you think do you have some connection to my mother? Brandish is just like, well, you should kill me, but if you're not going to do it, you're going to regret it. And she has this very menacing face.
Mm-hmm.
And then we cut outside to see that the creepy, like, ooh, you passed dude is still alive, which is very disappointing. I was hoping he'd be dead forever.
Yeah.
We see that the different fairy tale, or ally guilds, rather, are marching. Blue Pegasus and Sabretooth are coming in from the south, it looks like. Or no, they're coming to attack the army coming in at the north. And then Mermaid Heel and the other one, whose
name is
Lemia Scale, are coming in to take the ones in the south. That means that Fairy Tales group are going to have to handle the other ones. But they're breaking their teams up even more. So, Mira Jane, Elfman, Lasana, Gajeel, Levy, and Lily Panther are going to head out and team up with the group heading north. So Sabretooth and the other one, Blue Pegasus. And then Natsu, Gray, Yuvia, Wendy, and Laxus will meet up with the group heading south. So they'll meet up with the Lumia Scale and Mermaid Heel. And, you know, there's a couple comments between them all, you know, like, Lox is saying, like, oh, the machine freak is down south, is he? I don't know why I felt like he was Sylvester Stallone.
I'm Sylvester Stallone,
I'm going to break that machine guy down. You know, I love the kill. That's why I did the hand thing like everybody else did. He did the little bombs of bloody cutie play means that he wanted where you get hurt. Very hard.
Just said.
That's how Sylvester Stallone works, Nick. There's a lot of little comments like that.
And they're like, where is Natsu? And Urs is like, I'm sure he's fine. I'll go in his place. I'm totally fine.
They also note that Lucy and Connell will stay behind to guard their prisoner. And they're like, wait, where the fuck? Oh, wait, sorry. They note also that the east is where the biggest danger is. And they're like, well, what are we going to do to hold off them? And they say, don't worry. We have the strongest force in Fiore heading there. And that's where we see the four members of the ten wizard saints that we still know of. I forget where the others are, but these are basically, like, Jura's in there, Warid's in there, and the two other guys they introduced, basically number two and three, are in there. So those are essentially the Emperors of Ishkal, and they will be the ones to hold back those enemies. Mavis even notes that if an enemy should get past these three, there will be no one who can stop their advance.
They're silly kind of those, aren't they?
Yeah. And then everyone's like, hey, why is Natsu moving so fast? And we cut away, and Natsu is zooming off. And everyone's like, wait, where is he going? And one of the advisors for Zeref is like, Your Majesty, there's an object approaching at an incredibly high speed. And Zeref just smiles as we see Natsu is flying off towards him, screaming, let's finish this once and for all, Zeref! So a very interesting kind of end to the chapter. Natsu saying, fuck your strategies. I'm going to go fight the boss immediately. I'm going to system break here. Or sequence break, rather. I actually like this chapter a lot. I think it did some, you know...
But nothing happened.
Well, it did establish some exact purpose to it. It's a build-up kind of chapter of being like, alright, here's where those allied guilds are headed. Here's where these ones are. Here's the groups who are going to go meet them. Basically establishing where our characters should be. But it then ended that chapter in an exciting way by being like, oh, but Natsu's just going to say fuck that and head straight off to go fight Zeref. Now, I don't think this is going to be like them being like, oh, we're just going to cut that arc short. I think Zeref's going to do something to basically knock him away or just do something to stop this encounter from actually happening. We're going to follow through on all this other stuff. But I just think it's exciting to be like, oh, holy shit, Natsu's going to head straight towards the final boss. I thought that was an effective way to kind of end that chapter and build some excitement.
It's one of those things where it's like Fairy Tail wants to have those moments of, oh, this guy is so big and important and has arrived on the scene without doing all the work in between. You know?
Yeah.
So, you know, it's really just an entire chapter of these totally important people are heading in this direction. These totally important people are heading over here. And just like, I don't give a shit about any of those groups.
Yeah, though. I was like, that's the problem is that I just don't give a fuck about 80% of the characters.
Oh, good. Mermaid Heel and Blue Pegasus, and oh yeah, Lissana, you're gonna turn the tide.
Yeah, I'm like, oh wait, we get to see Blue Pegasus in action? We already got so much of Chia, can we stand to have more? Like, the snow guy, or the dude with computer magic?
Or the guy who looks like a Chia, but is a...
Oh yeah,
but is completely powerless?
The Exceed from the fucking other world that looks like him?
Oh god. Yeah, I mean, I was just like, I had no reaction to this chapter of Peridot. I had no reaction to it. Just like, well, okay.
Yeah, I can see it.
Next week for something to happen. Meanwhile, there's like apparently some like Christmas special chapter that came out, which is literally nothing but fan service. So, yeah.
Surprise.
Well, like all, like every character involved, including the males, provides fan service. So,
I've heard it. I haven't read it yet, though, so I don't know.
But yeah, let's just move on. Food Wars, Shokugeki no Soma, chapter 143. The opening volley is shot. So Aizon last chapter sent out a whole bunch of goons in order to forcefully kick people out of Polaris Dorm so that they could continue with the suddenly moved up eviction notice. So yeah, you know, Aizon is mocking Soma at the beginning of this chapter, saying he's like, oh yeah, by the time we're done, you know, they're all gonna have been cleared out of there. So there you go. And of course everyone is reacting to this. You know, the judges that Aizon has bought off are like one of the guys.
The one that beat Sylvester Stallone.
I guess head of the Shokugeki department or whatever is like, oh, you low life. And Rinda says, oh, Aizon, everything you do screams mob muck. You're just showing off just how small time you are. It's like, I like how she's just like being a little kid, basically. Yeah, he's like, oh, come on, stop it. Yeah, you're not being fun. So yeah, Aizon continues to mock Soma for a bit. People at the Polaris dorm are starting to freak out. They're like, okay, what are we gonna do? They're gonna kick us out of here. And so Fumio speaks up and says, look, if you just go along with them...
Nick, I don't think that's what an old woman would sound like.
If you aren't crying, do as you're told, Aizon, I'll blow over and you'll get to remain Totsuki students!
Oh, this is hard on me. I can't do this. I can't do that, no.
You want me to do it, Nick?
Go ahead.
Don't you think they'd be safer than resting them and bringing their heap of trouble down on your heads?
Well, are you telling us that we should give up?
Well, what else are you going to do?
Like a Gruntilda. Like I'm like a second away from just...
Tony's beauty I shall have. We have it, and you determined Yuki heretic and fight back? Even at the risk of getting expelled?
Everyone's like, dot, dot, dot. So, Aizon's just in the Shokugeki room, just kind of like, sits down, is like, hey. And so someone just raised a very good point, which is, if I win the Shokugeki, that means that the order to close the dorm is going to be canceled, so the eviction will get revoked, right? And they're like, huh? Okay, then I'll just concentrate my cooking. I have to give myself a little pat on the back for just throwing this out last week. But I love that he does it in a very Soma manner. We're just like, oh, so I just have to win. Okay, doo-doo-doo. Yeah. He just like starts washing his hands. Doo-doo-doo, gotta cook. No. And Rinda like goes to and be like, and is like, you know, I this is why I like you, Soma. You're just being all, you know, you're just really confident in yourself and you're being straightforward about it, but you know, and hey, compared to you, Mr. Four-Eyed Thug over there comes off as a creepy, spiteful jerk, doesn't he? And so it's like, yeah, I kind of thought that myself. Oh, stop butting in, Rindle. So I brought up last time, you know, my brief suspicion, is Rindle gonna somehow help someone out with this? And in her own way, she kind of is, and it makes sense because she wants to like stir things up and see what Soma can do. So she actually wants Aizon to actually confront him so that, you know, there will be a point behind them having the contest with each other and stuff. And meanwhile, Soma's going out, is like, oh, I'm gonna make pot stickers and stuff and with the chicken, and she's like, oh, well, aren't you going to wreck the special type of chicken's taste? And he's like, no, don't worry about it, I know what I'm doing. brief little cooking montage, and Azon finally speaks up, and it's just completely frustrated with them, where he's like, quit with all this futile resistance. We know how this is going to end. You'll lose, and you won't even have a home to go to either. You wanted to play the hero, and this is what you got. You're over. Through. You failed before you even started. Accept it. Accept it and admit you don't even have the will to stand in the kitchen anymore. And he sits back down, he's like, yeah. I sure told him off, yeah.
I'm awesome.
I sure bet, asshole. Why haven't they cleared out the dorm yet? And someone comes in, sir, a report from the eviction crew. Oh, are they done yet? No, they're being blasted with a hose. Because, according to Fumio, back in the heyday of the dorm...
Let's start telling the story.
They had to drive off people all the time, so they have, like, battle equipment at the ready with, like, hard hats and makeshift weaponry with a fire hose. So apparently this dorm was just hardcore back in the day. We get this little flashback scene of when Soma's dad and Jun were all attending together. And I like how they're, like, acting like, you know, tough guys, except for Jun, who's, like, hiding underneath a blanket. Basically, eventually, everyone was like not wondering what to do, and Megumi eventually, you know, spoke and said, "I don't want our dorm to get shut down. I'm not going to let that happen." And Fumi was like, "Okay, well, here's all of our stuff. You can fight them off as you see fit." I like that Megumi was like the one who said, "I don't want these members to disappear." The troops have been rallied, and they're all suited up, and they're fighting off Azon's goons, and Azon is making a face.
It is maybe the most glorious face I've ever seen someone make in a manga. This may be on, like, it's not a full page spread, so maybe it doesn't have the same impact, but I feel like that's a face on the exact same level as when Inaru zapped Luffy and realized he was immune to electricity. Like, it's very much like, what?
I did not know veins could pulse on your cheek. Like, seriously. And also, you can see up his nose.
Yeah, his nostrils flare up. His teeth are fucking out.
Oh, God. It's so hideous. So, yeah, he is really frustrated. He's like, oh, look what I've already done. I've cut off every last hope they have. That should have killed their desire to even set foot in the kitchen again. So why aren't they giving in? Not those freaks at the dorm. Nor him, either. And Soma speaks up and he says, you know, I can't help but notice that you really seem to like setting up all this complicated external stuff to get at people. If you have something you want to say to me, how about you put it on a plate? And Azon says, okay, Yukihira, I guess if I want to break you, the only way to do it is through cooking. And he takes off his glasses and gets ready to cook.
I think he's going to cook his glasses, Nick. That's my prediction for next week.
Behold, a real special ingredient.
My chicken glasses.
Chicken glass stew. Mm. Be very careful. It will shatter and you will cut your tongue up.
Yeah, it's actually not fit for human consumption.
No, but it looks very pretty. Yes. It's very nice.
You could wear it as regular glasses if you have my prescription.
You know, if you are willing to put up with these scalding hot meat and soup surrounding you. You will probably give yourself glasses-shaped scars. In fact, I don't recommend that either. It would work, but you would be in incredible pain.
I made a baseball manga around this exact same premise, actually.
I like this chapter overall. It's not as good as the last one, but I really like the final exchange between Soma and Azon. I think that just Soma saying is like, if you got something to say to me, put it on plate. You know, stop with all the bullshit. Get in the ring with me and let's throw down, basically. And Azon finally saying, okay, I'll show you why I'm really on the Council of Ten, basically.
Yeah, that's I've mentioned it for like 3 weeks now, or 4 weeks now. I'm like, I really want to see what this guy can do in cooking. So, it's very interesting to see how this is actually going to go, because we don't really know what this guy's style is or anything like that. And I wonder if he puts us all into it, because I know Yukihira Soma is doing pot stickers, which I know is like, this is going to be a very difficult dish because it's going to be tough to blend all that while still keeping the, you know, that flavor of that chicken as a forefront. So I want to know, like, what can Azon do to kind of compete with that? Mm-hmm. Maybe is he, like, going to be encouraged to, like, oh, I'm going to make something that's better, or, you know, like, I really just want to see what he can do with that.
Okay. Yeah.
Yes, and based on the fact, based on our poll thus far, still not closed yet, but apparently Food Wars was what our audience believes was the most was the best chapter this week.
Yeah, it's got a pretty healthy lead at this point. So, but we'll see how things are at the end of the podcast. Let's move on to My Hero Academia, number 67, Stripping the Varnish, as we basically wind down this whole testing mini arc. We first start off with I almost called him Kaminari, Kirishima, right? And Sato, as we are, I guess we knew his ability before, but we have to be reminded of it here. His ability is Sugar Rush, which is, you know, he can consume sugar and get incredible power for a brief period of time, but also it drops his kind of functions. And we also see that there's another side effect, which is he suffers from a sugar crash.
Oh, I did not. When I read cognitive function, I just like in my mind. I was like, oh, he gets stupid dumb. Like he's just.
No,
like,
he does. I imagine he does get dumb because he just goes sleepy, tired.
I think he's like, I become stronger and stronger and just get dumber and dumber as it goes along. But I punch thing now.
Yeah. So they are really struggling against the teacher who's just, you know, summoned like. Just this constant wall, set of walls around them, just pouring this constant set of concrete over them. So they're trying to smash their way through, but he observes, like, you guys are really bad at battles of attrition. You know, you've got to make use of your particular strengths, and instead just mindlessly pounding away at the walls around in front of them, and they're not making any progress. And then we don't actually see exactly what Ida and Ojiro did in order to pass their test. It looks as though Ida spent a lot of time distracting their teacher while Ojiro snuck out. I'm guessing that's what happened. But they managed to pass, and with very little time to spare, like only 5 minutes are left when he manages to do that. Then we cut to Uraraka's team with, I keep on forgetting this guy's name. He's the guy with the belly button laser, though.
Yeah.
And so 13 is trying to stop them with his body. Like they're basically doing, you know, the space vacuum. Oh no, the hangar door is open and we're gonna be sucked into space thing. So they're like, oh no, what are we gonna do? And so belly button laser guy is like, well, I can transfer the laser of my navel into my kneecaps, so we are in no pinch that I can see. And he shoots lasers backwards into 13, and he's just like, I can also absorb light. It's a black hole. And he just sucks
it.
And then his, like, cool glasses get sucked off, too, and destroys them, too.
And he just looks so sad. I think it looks like he almost goes cross-eyed when that happens.
Yeah. Aoyama's his name. And so Uraraka's like, oh yeah, but this is no joke! And he just says, I am what I am. So Uraraka starts to panic. He's like, oh no, what are we going to do? We're not going to be able to pass. Oh, and this, if I were Deku in this situation, what would I do? And Aoyama says, hey, you were just thinking if I were Izuku Midoriya, weren't you? You like him, don't you? And Uraraka gets embarrassed and claps her hands to her cheeks because she's blushing. Because she does that, she lets go of the guardrail she's hanging on to, flies back into 13, and so, to avoid killing her, he shuts off his black hole, and basically we cut away right before she smashes into him. And we're just kind of told that Shoji and Hakagure passed their mission, and it was like a seek and destroy type of deal. We don't actually hear what they did in order to pass.
He has what, four arms? Is that his thing? And then the other one's the Invisible Girl on that team. So we just really didn't know what happened in that. But I really don't get what the four armed guy's power really is.
Yeah, it would be very interesting to match a sniper against an invisible person though, wouldn't it? Yeah. Recovery Girl says, okay, well, the remaining teams are Kirishima and Sato, Kaminari and Ashido, and Uraraka and Aoyama. And so Deku's like, well, you know, I think that they all have decent odds. And Recovery Girl's like, oh, wait, there's also Mineta. And Mineta's still running around crying to himself. Like, oh, no, how am I supposed to pass this test? And they're like, oh, God, what are we supposed to do? And, you know, let's see. I guess this is Deku saying, you know, it might be Rick. I don't know whether it's Recovery Girl or Deku saying this, but they say, like, All Might and, you know, Present Mike and Cementos and Midnight, those are all really high hurdles, but people have different limits, and once you've admitted defeat to yourself, it's all over. And so, their teacher, who is the S&M girl, it's explained their ability, Midnight's ability is somnambulist. Oh, God. If you breathe in the aroma she emits, it will put her opponent to sleep, and it's more effective on men. And then the narration follows this up with, Whoa, baby! That's the narration saying this. Whatever.
I feel like your Ryan Brown wrote that part. I know he's not the editor for the series, but I feel like he had a hand in that line going in there.
So,
somnambulism is sleepwalking. I didn't know that.
Huh. So, Mineta, of course, is running around trying to avoid being caught, but also he's really angry at Sero, the tape wrist guy, because Sero threw him away, and now he's, like, crying tears of blood. He's so upset that he's not passed out on Midnight's lap instead. And so, yeah, he's just running around, and Recovery Girl's like, I don't know if he's gonna, you know, survive this, you know. The Academy is constantly preparing new barriers for you children, all in the hopes of getting you to push past your limits. In order to overcome it at all, without faltering, it's essential for each of you to have concrete goals in mind. Saying, I guess I want to be a hero, won't be enough to scale the mountains that lie ahead. Even if such a person were to become a hero, they would have no real future if that was their only goal to begin with. I have to wonder if that boy has even come up with a worthy goal. And immediately we cut over to Mineta, who's, you know, really tired, so he's putting his hands on his knees and just goes, I want to get chicks! I want to get chicks! I want to touch him! He is who he is, isn't he?
Yeah.
At that moment, Uraraka's team has managed to pass. She managed to just, I guess, react on instinct to slap the handcuffs on 13 when she knocked into him. She's looking really intense, too. Like, her irises and pupils are hidden. She's so intense.
In the shot where you see her getting sucked in, you can see her kind of turning, and the implication, I believe, is that she basically just turns her flying in into, like, a missile drop kick. Yeah, like, she kicks him. And she knows, like, it's just kind of the attitude she learned from her hero mentor. Like, she was a combat person, so
those
instincts just kind of took over, and it's kind of like a cool trait to add to her. She's like, so I just get badass.
Yeah. I instinctively whipped out what I learned from Mr. Gunhead. So, Mineta hears this announcement, of course, and he's like, oh man, everyone's passing this. Why is my test so tough? What the hell? And he remembers, you know, people questioning him, you know, why did you really come to this, you know, school to become a hero? And he's like, you know, was that so bad? He remembers, you know, basically everyone else in the class kind of getting ahead of him and stuff, and he's like, I wanted to be a hero so I could get chicks, and I thought being a hero would mean girls, girls, girls! And he's... Midnight has finally come for him, has finally abandoned, just waiting by the gate, and she's like, okay, you know, with this little time left, you know, I decided that, you know, it would just be no fun to just babysit the gate, and besides, watching you run and shriek like a baby makes the sadist in me ache for a chance to play. Oh my god, why are you a teacher?
It's weird that this dude, Mineta, has essentially become, like, Great to Onizuka, like that's his, like, it's his mindset basically. Like, I wanted to become a hero so I can get boobs.
Yeah, really. Yeah.
Maybe he'll also undergo a character development in the
Murderous
War.
See. Let's see. So Mineta covers up his mouth, realizing that, you know, he can't, you know, he can't risk inhaling Midnight's aroma. And she's like, "All right, well, you think you can really accomplish this? You know, what are you gonna do with your hands clamped over your face while you're doing that?" And so, you know, all he can do is run away. Mineta's thinking to himself, you know, ever since coming here, I'm practically dying. I finally get it. Being a hero doesn't make you cool. They're heroes because they're cool. Right, Midoriya? And finally, it seems like Mineta's got him completely cornered, and he comes out and he says, I was wrong. A pervy hero like you, there's no way I wouldn't be a fan of yours. Running away, whining like that, even bring out the sadist in you to lure you out here. It was all so that one day I could be a cool dude. And he rushes in towards her and he's got Sero's tape wrapped around his face. from that one brief moment when he was tossed away, and he throws a barrage of his sticky globes at her, a whole bunch of them hit Midnight's whip, and he's, like, explaining while his mouth is muffled so he can, so there's, like, gotta be translations for it. It's like, there's no need for me to fight because my special move is already in play, and he just dashes past her while her whip is stuck to the ground. And he just basically outruns her and picks up Sarah and gets to the finish line. And he passes. And he's like, all right, Sarah, just this one time, I'll let you have those boobs. I fucking love this.
Fair enough, sir.
It's so fucking stupid, but it's like, somehow Mineta got to have a moment where he was kind of cool in his own way.
I do like him using the tape. I like it when they kind of incorporate, like, yeah, all the characters are important. It's why I'm kind of curious what Ida's fight was like.
Yeah.
I'm like, how did you use the tail guy's power?
And then I like how it's like, he's not, you know, turning on a dime and being like, okay, I'll be a serious hero now. But he has taken a bit of a step forward, and he realizes that he's... And it's actually... I'll admit, I'm not sure if he actually had a plan, or if he was just trying to sound cool at the end when he panicked and thought of something.
I think it's the latter.
I do think that he did improvise something deliberately at the end. I have a hard time believing that all of that test was him luring Midnight into a trap, because that seems against his character.
He seems like he's too blunt of a character for this to be like, oh no, he was definitely planning to hide it all along.
Right. I mean, he did think of something clever to do, which I'll give credit for that. I don't know if that was his plan from the beginning, because he does try and seem like make a really big deal out of it. Like, this was all part of my master plan! It's like, I don't know, man. I don't know if I believe that from you. Anyway, the test ends, and very importantly, not everyone passed it. Ashido's team and Kirishima's team failed. Sarah, they just weren't able to defeat the principal or Cementos. And we cut very briefly to them as the narration says, like, you know, some people managed to grow, but others couldn't push past their limits. And that was the bittersweet ending to the practical portion of our final exam. And I do like this, that, you know, it's like not everyone was able to pass. Because, I mean, yeah, you're not always, not everyone's going to be able to pass in real life and stuff. And so, yeah, even though everything was, like, designed specifically for these individual students to have something so they could grow, not all of them actually passed the exact qualifications of the exam, and they can still learn.
Sad, Nick. I feel bad for Sugar Man. Sugar Dude.
Yeah. Because they look so sad when they're looking at each other.
Yeah, they look heartbroken. They failed.
And Ashido looks so frustrated, and Kaminari is just slumped over in defeat in the background. So it's like, yeah, they really, really, really wanted to pass, and they couldn't. So. Yeah.
And I think I have to feel it's intentional for, like, the way these character arcs are going to go. Because it seems like everyone got a little bit of something, and they were making a bigger deal about Ashido and the electric guy recently. Mm-hmm. So I have to feel like they're like, no, we're not just kicking him out of the school. Like, there's something that's going to happen. I feel like there's growth from this.
Going to have, like, summer school or some shit like that.
Some.
So, but at that moment, we cut to Shigaraki's base of operations, as narration explains, it's time for the villain group to make their third move, and each time they were defeated, they came back stronger. As basically there are a couple of new recruits coming in. Importantly, Shigaraki is looking at a piece of paper at the beginning, and when they come in, he crumbles into dust. So you gotta wonder, it's like, oh, what the fuck was that?
It's a picture of Deku.
Oh, it is.
You see the panel before.
Oh, I didn't look at that. Arr!
Nick's like, I wonder what he was looking at.
It was a picture of Deku, Nick. How do you know that? Look at the picture before.
Yeah, I'm like, the panel before it. Like, what superfluous material did you have to read? What form did
what
you have
My
to delve
What My Hero Academia data book did you read to get that information? It's called the panel before, you idiot.
did you visit Horikoshi?
What
Sensei?
ISBN number is that, Chris?
Nick, did you have to go into the darknet to find out?
So, we're introduced to a couple of new... I think it's a couple of new characters, but the girl calls the guy Mr. Stainy. Now, very confused by this.
Well, remember, there was a chapter way back at when Stain revealed, like, his villain speech. that they showed it, it was inspiring a new group of villains, and they cut to a whole bunch of different ones. This girl was definitely among them, and I believe the guy was as well.
Okay. For a second, I was like, wait a minute, is the guy with all the scars Stain? Wait a minute. Wait. Because she
says I think she's just referring to him because that's okay. The person who inspired them. So she's like, oh, is this your friend, Mr. Stainy? Even though he's not there.
Right. Because she's kind of nuts.
Yeah.
Okay. And she's very happy to be there. So yeah, it's this guy who has this... He looks like he's got a bit of a Glasgow smile going on. Like, the sides of his mouths look like they've had to be stitched back together. He's got weird scars going all along his body below that point. And then the other girl is just this girl in this Sailor Fuku with something hanging from her pocket, and that's about it. But she's acting crazier, the two. Because the guy with all the scars is like, you're gross. Like, yeah, he is. So yeah, that's the end of the chapter. We're done with all the exams and stuff. It was a cool little arc. And yeah, moving on to more plot progression and stuff. So good stuff from My Hero Academia.
Yes.
Alright. Nisekoi, the arc is over. Okay. it wrapped up a little bit too neatly for my taste. Just like, okay, fine. Was just like, yeah, okay, whatever. Toriko. It's a montage of them preparing all those golden cookware stuff that were brought up in the last chapter in Gourmet 347. Tested knights. It's just cutting around to all the different people who are trying to do this stuff. Chin 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 is trying to keep up with, you know, supplying all of the calories and so on and so forth. Komatsu has a talk with Chako's mother and a new body and so on and so on. And nothing really happens.
Yeah, I know.
They explain, like, they talk more about the flow of time being different and so on and so forth. And they talk about how much time has already passed for the gourmet nights and so on. And then we cut to Don Slime's copy room where he's like looking over like this clone of Ichiryu, where he's like, oh, where did your soul go, Ichiryu? I finished the copy of your body. Now come back. I want to share a meal with you again. Bring back Ichiryu, really? That's all I got from this. Like,
yeah, that's all you have.
I don't like this trend we have of, you know, going through a chapter of Toriko and just being like, I don't get it. I don't know what's going on.
Yeah.
But it is really not giving me a lot to work with, in my opinion.
Well, here's the thing. I'm going to fully admit this. I really am not able to follow Toriko, and mostly that's due to my own disinterest in the series. Because there was a period of time where the series got, like, kind of threw a lot of stuff at us, and I just kind of was like, I don't really care for this. What it did is I turned my brain off and I just didn't follow Toriko as closely as I should have, because it didn't speak to me, it didn't interest me anymore. And because of that, everything I'm trying to do now, I can't really just pick it back up. This is something that I'm going to have to wait until it's kind of out in volumes, or just after the arc's done, go back and kind of read through it again, because trying to catch up on it right now is like an impossibility. It's just, there's so much going on right now, you can't just really kind of jump back into it. So, as it is now, I'm not going to say, like, I'm giving up on Toriko. I'm still reading it. It's just to really comprehend everything, to truly grasp everything that is happening in a week-by-week basis, it's just not going to happen for the time being. Like, I just don't have that ability right now.
Shame.
Remember when it was our manga of the year, Nick?
I do. Right. Yeah. Let's wrap things up with World Trigger Chapter 122, Aikitora, Part 5. So, yeah, we get some more, a little bit more explanation on, hey, you know, when Kitora was, you know, when she was B rank, she was a gunner, she switched to using a scorpion, but, you know, because she didn't have enough try-on to be a gunner, she couldn't expend it on bullets and stuff. But we actually started to win a lot more when she joined us. So, you know, she knows how to fight as a squad, so I think she can help you out. And Osama's like, oh, awesome! And Kitora says, no, I decline. And I don't think Mikumo's not going to be able to beat the B-rank teams, even with training. And also, by the way, my try-on is better now, too. So, yeah, it's not going to help. So, I forget what their director's name is. I keep on forgetting her name.
Oh, their operator?
Their operator's name, yeah. Yeah. Because she hasn't actually showed up as much as the others do. So she's like, well, you don't have to be so harsh with them. You know, he was recommended to us, and Kitora says, look, I get angry when I see someone wasting their efforts. Effort is used to achieve goals. What are your goals? And if someone says, well, I want to join the next away team. Well, you only have a few matches left, and in order to get to a point where you're eligible for selection, so I don't think, do you really think that just practicing a little bit, having a few matches, you think you're going to be on par with all those people who are trying to get picked too? I mean, you would need 2 years of training and stuff. And someone says, look, I don't want to give up on this. I want to accomplish these goals. So Kitora still keeps on talking down to him and so on and so forth. Their operator says, he brought us sweets. Come on, don't be so harsh on him. And Kitora says, don't be swayed by food. Eventually, Osamu's just like, all right, you're saying I shouldn't train, so is there a better way to do this? And Kitora says, well, I'm under no obligation to teach you. And she says something that's quite strange, because she says, are you used to others being nice to you? Let me tell you something, you know, when Ninomiya, who was the top B rank agent at the time, he once begged Izumi to be his mentor and to teach him techniques he lacked. Even though he had one of the highest trine levels in Border, he was already the number one shooter, he begged to be helped. It sounds like he's the direct opposite of you. And so Osamu, you know, stands up and bows his head very deeply to Kitora and says, I beg you, I need your help. And Kitora finally agrees to help him out a little bit. It's a weird thing. I admit, I don't quite get where Kitora's coming from.
It's a little bit of a cultural difference. The thing is that, I guess, what he's doing is saying Ninomiya bowed to Izumi to be his mentor. And that's essentially what Osamu does. When she says, sounds like he's the direct opposite of you, my impression is that it's like, Ninomiya has a shit ton of tryon. He's extremely talented. He bowed to someone who he wanted to learn from, to teach him the techniques he lacked. You have no tryon. You need help, and all you're doing is asking for help. So she's basically saying, I want you to treat me with respect. It is kind of douchey, but Kitora is a very rough person, and they note that. She's rough, not just on others, but she's very rough on herself. You know, Kikuchi Kawa, whatever his fucking name is. I keep forgetting his name every week.
Kikuchi Hara?
That's the dude in Kazami Squad. Kazuma Squad. But he's knowing that's what she does, too. So she has a very rough attitude. She's very mean to him right now, and I can understand why people are looking at this very abrasively, and they're kind of like, wow, Kitora really is a bitch on this. I think what it is she's really trying to get the best out of Osamu, and she needs to see how dedicated he is, and she wants to see that he is willing to bring himself to the same level, I guess, probably she was at one point. Because she's known time and time again, during Osamu's whole training in these last few months, you know, he's doing this, but he's thinking he can just catch up with people just from hard work and training. It's not necessarily that's all it's going
she's
to take.
She's basically interpreting it as she interprets it because he thinks that he is going to be able to catch up, that he's underestimating how difficult it is, and so she interprets that as him lacking respect for what she has accomplished and what everyone else in Horror at her level has had to go through in order to accomplish it.
That, and she's gonna be like the Iron Sheik. She's like, I want to make you humble. You know, she wants him to kind of graft exactly.
Break your back, fuck your ass.
Yeah, so I get it, and I guess maybe the reason
that's Osamu Kitora points, by the way.
Yeah, it is. There's not a lot of those that's going right into the fan page. But a big part of this also, the reason I don't have any issue with that part, and why I totally get it, is I know people in my life who are very much in the style of Kitora, where their way of kind of getting the best out of you is to really kind of pull it out of yourself. So I don't have an issue with that kind of style or anything like that. There are my friend Randy, you met him more than a couple times. That's his kind of style of trying to get someone to do something. He's not going to sugarcoat or anything like that. Very blunt. So I've seen that kind of style before. So when Kitora does it here, I think other people, they're like, that's, you know, you're being a real bitch. I guess I kind of see that logic in it, though, where it's just like, she's being honest. Like, it's the only way this guy's going to learn is he needs someone who's going to be tough on him. And one of the biggest ways to be tough on him is be like, show me some fucking respect, bitch.
I mean, yeah. I mean, she is right. Mm-hmm. She has no obligation to teach him. So, yeah. So everyone's like, oh, come on, be nice to him. She's like, no, I don't have to. He's like, yeah. Well, he brought us food, though. So?
And part of it is she's also a little bit bitter at Osamu because he's, you know, he's getting trained by Karasuma and she has a crush on him.
So Kitori's like, all right, here's a trigger that I'm going to teach you how to use. It's called the spider. It's a trigger that uses wires. And she basically says, like, okay, look, it doesn't take a whole lot of try on. You start off with this little cube. It's got these little prongs on either side of it. You hold the, you point the hooks in the direction you want the wires to go, and then boop, and then it just shoots out. And that's all you need to do. And so, you know, Osama's like, all right, so you use this to, like, obstruct enemies' movement with the wires? And Kitori says, yeah, but, you know, it doesn't use much try-on. You can adjust the color of it so it'll be a little bit more difficult to spot. And you can set it so that only your allies can see the wires clearly by adjusting it with your, in conjunction with your operator. You can use it, you know, in combination with meteors and stuff once you get more try-on, but that's out of the question for you. Anyway, and there's this, there's another kind of awkward moment where Osama's thinking something, and he's like, and Kitori's like, look, if you got something to say, just say it. And Osama says, okay, I don't really see how I could be on par with the top if I use this. Well, you can't. Yeah. And so she's like, look, I mean, you can still notice the wires if you're inspecting them, and people will be able to avoid them and cut them. And so unless you get the conditions just right, these traps are hardly ever going to work because people are familiar with all those tricks and stuff. They're not very popular to use because they don't lead to people scoring any points in their recent spot and so on and so forth. And Osama, of course, says, well, what's the point of you teaching me this? And she says, look, these are all...
Look, only things. Tardo!
These are all only things if you fight by yourself. People fail to understand that the purpose of a trap isn't only to take out a target. Just making them think there's a trap makes an enemy hesitate. When they're wary of traps, their attention is diverted. And so, for someone with real talent, you know, like your team's ace, this will be a really big help if you could just be a distraction. And they go over how, you know, when Osama was just present in the hallway during the big three-way fight in the last match, they had to divide their attention because he was just there. So, if you add a trap, then you can help out that. And also, Kitori's like, oh, you know, the wires will stay behind after you're defeated. You can still be supporting your allies if you're eliminated, even if you're the first one eliminated. So you can place them on these different areas on your map so that those parts of the map are only going to be favorable for your allies. And also, and if someone's like, oh yeah, this means I don't actually need to hit the enemy because the buildings and ground don't move, so they won't...
Yeah.
I like how Kitori puts it. No matter how clumsy you are, you will be able to set wires wherever you want in a couple of days. So Osama's like, well, this is actually probably the perfect solution for someone like me. And so he's like, so maybe for the first time I might be looking forward to the next match just a bit more than usual. And we close on the note of, though, him having just been taught this, and Chika practicing her sniping with her friends, and Yuma being, I guess, teased by Kakko.
Yeah.
To, like, pull on his hoodie and stuff. And I guess this is probably drawing to a close most of the in-between time between matches and stuff, but I really like what we got in this whole sequence. I like how all three members of Tamakomatsu got to go off and do stuff and step forward in different ways. Except for Yuma, who didn't need it. But
yeah, Yuma's already kind of awesome. So right. I like this chapter a lot. I think I can definitely see where there's maybe a little bit of awkwardness in the way kind of some of the dialogue comes out. But I like it. I mean, first, it's my two favorite characters had a long, protracted conversation with each other, so I mean, I love it on that regard. But I think this was a solid chapter. I like the way Kitori kind of explains this all. I can certainly say I never expected this to be Osamu's kind of strategy, but it does make a lot of sense for him. It's, you know, a way for him to affect the field. And I like that it seems to finally have been hammered into his head. Like, you don't actually have to physically score the points to help your team. You need to be the leader, and this is kind of a way for you to do it.
And I do really enjoy, like, you know, he had to fail in order to, you know, open his mind to more possibilities. It was implied that Kitori, you know, before that happened, knew that he was going to fall on his face and knew the solution for it, and he was going around still asking more people. Finally, it was just like, you should ask Kitori for help, and he was like, hey, Kitori, can you help me?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll just help you after you ignored... did it kind of begrudgingly, but she did help him at the end. So.
Yeah. Now, it is worth noting that World Trigger's off next week. It's not noted in the chapter, but I guess apparently, like, the table of contents has been seen in Japan, and I guess there was kind of an unexpected injury or something like that, off next week, which is a bummer. I feel like World Trigger is, like, almost a monthly series now, even though it's not. Happens more frequently, but I feel like it's always gone. Still, I'm happy to see what this is. However, this isn't my favorite chapter of the week, I don't think, because...
Yeah, let's get into that now.
Ultimately, this is a chapter that's leading up to something that's going to be a great chapter. This is more build-up, and I think it might be just about time for us to finally get that payoff.
Okay. That said, I mean, yeah, it's time to wrap up Weekly Manga Recap, so let's name...
3 hours long.
Well, we had a long conversation about Onizuka, yeah. So... Let's name our series of the week. My personal series of the week is My Hero Academia. I really like what we got out of this. I liked the... everything that I said earlier, you know. I mean, the seeing that some of the characters failed, we got at least glimpses of what most of the teams went through, even if it was just like, they passed and stuff. And also the thing where Uraraka kind of lucks into winning the test was really funny. Mineta's thing, I actually adored it. And yeah, I really, really liked it this week. That was my favorite. What's your series?
This was tough. This was a good week of Jump.
It was a
but there
really
was
good week.
Nothing that stood out. Every chapter felt okay. I don't feel like anyone really blew me away.
Have you not made your decision yet?
I've had my decision. I feel like I've been arguing against it in my mind mentally throughout the week and even during the show, but I'm just good. Black Clover is my chapter of the week.
Okay.
It was legitimately a very funny chapter, and I guess that was surprising, and there was no other chapter this week that I thought really had, like, a payoff that gave me something otherwise. There were good bits and everything, but I guess Black Clover this week was my favorite just because it was legitimately a chapter I enjoyed all the way through.
And it was also a very exceptional chapter. So, All right, let's name our weekly MVP. The audience series of the week, by the way, it did hold at Food Wars, so that is going to win it for the audience. So my weekly MVP is Kitora. It shouldn't, for the reason we basically went over, as much as I tend to stray a little bit more into the area of she's kind of being a little bit of an asshole to Osamu, she was really interesting. She said some surprising things, basically, and she treated Osamu in a way that I was not really expecting. But at the same time, she also had some, you know, interesting points to make. And also, the whole wire thing actually did surprise me and stuff. So, gotta be here all the way.
On that same track, my MVP is Noelle from Black Clover, because it was very surprising to me. I did not expect, like, that character to be able to make me laugh that much. I don't want this to sound like it's any commentary on World Trigger. I enjoyed this chapter of World Trigger a lot, but this is a build-up chapter that I think needs to see the payoff for me to really enjoy it.
Okay. All right. So that's going to do it. We got Black Clover, Noelle, My Hero Academia, and Kitora, and Food Wars, which means that now that that's all edited, I am going to make the little spreadsheet that I've been keeping over the last couple of weeks available to people to check out. I believe it sets it, nobody can edit it, but you can all see it and watch it and stuff. And oh, the anonymous animals are pouring in!
I can't type anything.
No! So yeah, that is, keep that thing saved, or maybe we'll like put it on the WMR Twitter. We'll have to make sure. Just make absolutely certain that you can't edit it.
Yeah, I can't. I'm typing in it right now, and I can't. All right,
awesome. Okay, so yeah, that is that. So let's close out the show. Thank you everybody for joining us for the recording of Weekly Manga Recap. We now record on hitbox.tv/RoloT. We still record Wednesdays at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We do need to change that up probably next week, because it's Thanksgiving week next week. So stay following us on Twitter and stuff for updates. There's the @WMRPodcast Twitter handle, and also us individually, @RoloT and @YRulerOfTime.
And also, make sure to give a follow to our special guest this episode, Yezu Otaku, which you can follow @YezuOtaku. That's J-E-S-U Otaku, I think you could probably spell, but yeah.
It's that thing that people keep calling you guys.
Yeah.
They
yell at me when I'm walking to the bus. Like, Otaku, go home! And it's me like, cowards! It's like that movie.
Okay. Also, be sure to check out past episodes on weeklymangarecap.podbean.com and also subscribe to us on iTunes. Plus, you can leave a comment and rating so that we can beat the woodworking podcasts.
We did. We got a couple more, though, so we're a good fight is happening. I want to give a thank you to Lockdown080, who says, 10 out of 10 would Jar Jar again. And Zephael Navarez, I think this is after the Jar Jar episode, before I listen to it. Zephael Navarez says, a weekly podcast that covers manga releases and fan fan recommendations. These two work off of each other and provide some very hilarious and enjoyable conversations to listen to. So thank you, both of you.
Also, be sure to send us your thoughts, questions for us to answer, suggestions for future manga for us to read to weeklymangarecap@yahoo.com so that we can have future topics of conversation and such like. Special thanks go out to all of our Patreon supporters. Your support allows us to create all sorts of bonus content for you guys to enjoy. We recently did the commentary on Yu-Gi-Oh! Pyramid of Light, which is available on Patreon, right?
Yes. It's up now. I put it up today, so you can grab the MP3 and then you can play it. And I believe Credo Prime has actually made it so there's a track out there that links directly to the movie and plays over top of it, so you can check with him. I think he's on Twitter at Carito Prime if you want to get that directly.
Right. But watch that until the copyright holders take it down.
Yes, the commentary track is free to everybody. You can get it on Patreon, but you don't have to be a patron to get it. Everybody can access it.
So yeah.
And I want to give a special thanks also to our new patrons, Aaron Cooper, James Ristig, Terrence Swift, and Jelly Elfson. Thank you to all of you guys for supporting the show.
We will be recording our bonus episode on Naruto The Last very soon, so that we'll be able to get it out by the end of the month. That's what's coming up from that. And special thanks go out to Steve Mann, our Tarak artist. You can check out his artwork in many different places. He's got a Patreon, patreon.com/Steve Mann. He's on Tumblr in, I think, two, maybe more places. And also he's got
everywhere. He's the Matrix.
He's also got DeviantArt and Neurotic Fanboy. Special thanks as well go to the creators of the visual editions of our podcast, those being The Infamous Planet and Felix Dark. And yes, I said The Infamous Planet again, because as long as it pisses him off, I'm going to keep on using that art.
Don't do that, Nick. He has such a hard life. He's listening to this. I think it's probably Christmas by the time he's finally got around to listen to this episode. So.
Well,
I
couldn't be bothered.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's everything. Chris, what are we going to be reading next?
All right, guys, so we're almost into December. We basically got, I think, 1 week left in November. So I want to make it so Christmas is a special month. We do some cool things, give back, we're going to have guests on, new World Trigger to My Heart, Backdoor is going to be going on during it. And as part of that, I want to read a series that's been recommended to us a lot. It's a little bit of a longer one, but not that long because it was canceled before it could go on that long. So we're going to be taking a look at Siren, the Shonen Jump series. The same author who did Kagami Gami. It's one a lot of people really enjoyed, and I think that it's going to be a fun one. And I don't want to say anything. I don't want to guarantee it, Nick. But I do believe we may have a special guest on that episode. One who's even in the chat room and seems very excited that we're doing this. I'm not going to say if she will. I don't know if they'll line up exactly, but it might.
Your mind. We'll see. We'll see what happens.
So there we go. That's it, Nick.
Okay.
Anything else you want to add before we head off here?
I'm afraid that my vocal cords are going to collapse. We've been talking for 3 hours.
Oh no. Did we actually do it, Nick? A 3-hour episode?
We're very close.
We gotta stop quickly then.
No, the call hasn't been going on long enough. It hasn't been 3 hours, and we also had technical difficulties at the start. So we're actually good for a few more minutes.
Oh, cool. We can relax a little bit. Like,
let's just, like, not talk. Just kind of, like, lean back.
Let's casually talk, Nick. Like, so, how the Bucks doing?
We won this week.
That's awesome, man. Bucks deserve more success.
Yeah. It was really scary, but we won.
It's like last minute, too. You beat the Cowboys.
Yeah, they're not doing so hot right now.
No, they're not. That's pretty nice. I always enjoy when the Cowboys lose.
Have you been watching wrestling at all recently?
I haven't watched wrestling in a while, Nick. I don't even know if it was Seth Rollins champion, I believe.
Well, he had to vacate it because he fucked his knee up.
Oh, that's a bummer, man. That could be a career-hurting thing.
yeah, well, hopefully he's going to be fine.
Who's the champ now, then?
It's vacant. They're going to decide a Survivor Series.
Oh, okay.
It's going to be either Roman Reigns or Dean Ambrose, most likely.
Oh, Dean Ambrose champ. That'd be interesting.
Yeah. I mean, it looks like they're going to meet in the finals, and probably one of them's going to turn heel. But we'll see.
Aw. Have you seen Spectre yet?
No, I really want to, though.
You have to see it, and you have to tell me if you also noticed the scene where James Bond throws a handful of asparagus at Batista.
Oh, really?
Yeah, this is like a small spoiler for Spectre, but I'm just shocked where people aren't talking about it. There's a scene where Batista's chasing him through a train, and James Bond is, like, getting his ass kicked, and he runs into the dining cart, and it's like a kitchen cart, like, full of kitchen equipment that can hurt people, like, flaming pans and hot oil and sharp knives. And of all these things, super special agent James Bond grabs like a pan full of asparagus and throws it at Batista. And he's just like,
No, you gotta watch out, Dave. It's gonna make your pee smell weird.
He's like, what are you doing? I got hit in the head of the candlestick a couple minutes ago.
Spear!
Alright, well, do we want to kill more time?
I don't know what else we can talk about. I don't know. I don't want to think of anything else to talk about.
Do we want to just sit here in silence, grumbling silence?